Doug, since that was a bird, that
I will open the Senate Interim Committee on Rules for September 21st, 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, if you could please all have a seat. We have about 50 minutes to an hour of informational meetings before we get into our interviews on appointments. And so we do not actually have more than 50 minutes to an hour for these informational meetings because we have 43 interviews to conduct in the remaining 2 hours of the period that this meeting is scheduled.
All right.
The first item for an informational meeting is, Mr. Attorney General, would you come forward? And Mr. Michael Crone, is the Attorney General's Government Transparency Initiative. Aaron, did you want to give just a quick lead-in on this, or are you going to defer to the Attorney General?
I was going to defer to the Attorney General.
Oh, that's fine. We'll defer to the Attorney General.
Chair Devlin, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. I'm joined by Michael Crone, who's an Assistant Attorney General, and Tony Green, who is our Press and Policy Director at the Department of Justice. I know we're pressed for time, so I'll give a very brief summary of our transparency initiative, what we've done to date, and where we are headed. I would say, as an introduction, that traveling around the state, it is very clear that the overwhelming majority of citizens in the state want to have a very transparent government, and that this issue is not a left versus right issue. It's not particularly ideological. That's a value shared by Oregonians across the left-right divide. When I came into office, we started a review of Oregon's transparency laws, the public records law and the public meetings law, and we reached the conclusion that over time there's been a significant decline in transparency in Oregon's government. The simple benchmark I would give you that captures that, when the public records law was first passed in the 1970s, there were roughly 55 exceptions identifying kinds of records that do not need to be disclosed to the public. In our review, we have counted over 405 exceptions to date, exemptions to the current public records law. Every session we've added numerous additional exemptions, and over time there's been a significant erosion in transparency as a result. Some of the things that we've done internally that we could do without statutory changes, including putting the public meetings and public records manual online. Previously it was only available in a hard copy and you had to pay $20 to get it, and it seemed to me a mistake to charge citizens for a copy of the rules governing transparency in the state. So that manual is now available online, and it is searchable, so people don't have to lug a copy around. If there's a public meeting they're attending and they need to refer to the manual, they can simply go online and search it using a phone or a computer. Second, we created a citizen's guide, which is a very short summary of the transparency laws in the state. Because the public records manual, as many of you know, is extraordinarily dense and very detailed, since it's really primarily used for advice to government officials. And finally, we changed the internal process in the Department of Justice for appeals of denials of public records requests in state government. Those requests are often, there's a consensus in the department about what the correct legal answer is, but at times they are tough cases and our attorneys disagree. And we've created a process whereby in those tough cases, they come to me personally as Attorney General. This is not really because I'm particularly wise, but because the law requires a public interest balancing in many of those cases. And that appeals process has now resulted in a decision to overturn some prior rulings from the Department of Justice. One example, historically, the state universities have not disclosed their sports marketing agreements with Nike because those contracts between a corporation and the state universities was held to be best left secret under the public interest balancing test, and I reversed that decision. I believe it's better if the citizens actually know what the relationship is between the state universities and our largest corporation. We are now at the process of developing legislative proposals for a series of ideas that we believe will increase transparency, we intend to bring the legislature a statute in the 2011 session. The statute will deal with four sets of issues. First, as I noted, exemptions have ballooned from 55 to over 400 over the years. It's not just the number, it's the disorganization. As many of you are aware, the exemptions are scattered throughout the statute book. They're very hard to find. This makes it very difficult for citizens to know what exemptions may or not apply in a case. It also raises costs of compliance because often a governmental entity will have to hire a lawyer to search the statute book to see whether an exemption does or does not apply. So you're going to get a proposal from us to reduce the number of exemptions and significantly reorganize them. The question of deadlines by which government entities have to respond to requests is critical. Oregon has no deadline. A governmental entity is allowed to provide the records whenever it is, in effect, reasonable for them to do so. 33 states in the District of Columbia do have deadlines. Some of them are with greater or lesser exemptions and flexibility, and we are working on a proposal to address that issue of deadlines. In our meetings around the state on transparency, this issue came up time and time again. People submitting requests, having no idea when they'll receive an answer. Often the time by which they need the records will have passed before they receive them. Often they're in limbo. The request is not denied. They simply don't know what's happened to it. And so we think addressing the deadline issue would be a major advance. Third is the question of the fees that a governmental entity can recover. Obviously, with government at all levels being cash-strapped, recovering fees to cover the cost of providing records is very often essential. Government can't afford to do this without fee recovery in a great many cases. 11 states, however, have put some kind of limits or caps around fees in order to give citizens greater certainty about the kind of fees they can be charged in order when they've requested records. This is critical because we have heard some complaints from citizens around the state that often the fee estimate they receive, they believe, is exaggerated or exorbitant in order simply to chill their advocacy and prevent them from continuing to pursue their public records request. Fourth, we've heard in our public meetings around the state much less criticism about the public meetings law than the public records laws. I think the public meetings law has worked generally very well, and there were many fewer complaints about that. One issue that did come up repeatedly is a feeling that often minutes are inadequate for those members of the citizens of the body politic who are not able to attend a meeting. There's a feeling that they're often delayed. There's a feeling that often they don't accurately represent what happened at a meeting, not typically out of ill will, but because a lot of public bodies simply don't have a trained secretary who understands the proper way to take minutes. And one proposal which came up repeatedly is the idea of recording some public meetings and having a requirement for at least some public entities to provide an audio transcript of the meetings on their website so that people who do not wish to rely solely on the minutes will have access to those digital recordings. And finally, we heard a lot of discussion, particularly within government, about the need of better training for volunteer public servants and career public servants alike on how to better comply with the public records and public meetings laws. And so we're going to try to address that training issue as well, because it obviously a lot of the disputes that come around public records really aren't driven, I think, by a desire of government to hide records, but it's done out of ignorance about what the law requires or a fear that they may be violating the law if they disclose records when, in fact, that's probably not the case. So the legislation is currently underway, and we're going to release a full report within the next week or two that summarizes all of the findings from our six hearings around the state. So we will certainly submit a copy of that report to the legislature when it's available. And we'll be working on a draft of the legislation throughout the fall. And so would, of course, very much welcome input from members of this body so we can incorporate that in the draft. And with that, Chair Devlin, I'll just thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that the panel might have.
Questions for the Attorney General or questions? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I'll use this opportunity about transparency to ask you a couple of things. Number one is a few weeks ago, an issue was raised with the Department of Energy, which your department is now participating in an investigation, among others. And I was surprised to hear, and in fact consulted with our counsel, who actually agreed with me on this. That's why, why I wanted to bring it to your attention. I found it very surprising that when a newspaper in the state requested the contract, or at least one of the contracts that was involved in the investigation, an extremely broad lack of transparency ruling came from your office that because we were involved in an investigation, that was not available. And my counsel agreed that it seems to be pushing the boards of transparency and public records to say something that was a public record one moment before is no longer a public record. And one can understand communications, things that evolved as a result of that public record that you want to investigate that may not be available. But to take a public record one moment and make it a non-public record the next seems to be expanding and a lack of transparency, and I'd love to have your comment on that.
Sure, Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger. I could ask Michael to describe a little bit more detail the parameters of the criminal investigations exemption under the public records law. But the goal of that exemption is very clear, which is to allow the government to withhold information from the public if it believes that disclosing that might in some way jeopardize an investigation, disclose leads that the government may wish to follow in the course of its investigation without having interference from citizens or the press. I will tell you, as a prosecutor, it is often very important that we get to witnesses first rather than a reporter who may get a partial interview and publish some facts which may or may not turn out to be correct. And, I think any experienced prosecutor who's had cases that were in of media interest has had experiences where a lead that winds up in the hands of the public can have a negative impact on your ability to successfully investigate and prosecute a case. In the case of the Department of Energy case, I don't want to comment on the ongoing investigation other than to say that I personally made the decision about whether to disclose some of those records, and I did so because I believed that if we disclosed them, that might jeopardize some of the leads that we were following. I recognize that someone who seeks 100% transparency in all cases would find fault with that. I would hate to not be able to successfully prosecute a case because the investigation fell flat because of a lead that did not get pursued properly. So I made that decision, one can disagree with it, but that's why I made that decision.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. And it's one of the things about that I have found, having never been a lawyer, thank heaven, my mom said she would disown me after being first in the media, then in public service, and she said if I ever became a lawyer, she would totally disown me. So putting that caveat aside that have all those experiences in that field, but I have noticed over the years, both in the media and in my role here in the legislature, is that it is common practice for lawyers never to want anybody, they don't want to give out any information or whatever. I mean, that's why in my own personal business, public relations is good, because you're usually trying to fix things that the lawyers have goofed up because they didn't understand the potential impact of some of the things that were going on. So I understand the need to do that, the desire to do that. And as you have mentioned, there has been a number of expansions of the public record law. I'm proud to say I think I voted against almost all of them, but they have expanded and makes it more difficult for the public to connect the dots. But we do have to be careful in that as we look at whether a particular case or whatever the precedent we're setting, this goes all the way back to Watergate, and the executive privilege. Well, yeah, if it's our privilege, we don't want anybody to know anything, but that's not exactly maybe in the best interest of the public. And I just think that's something that, as you look at transparency, maybe the next legislative assembly should look at, is to maybe more closely defined, you know, what can be, you know, used under this very powerful umbrella, saying, well, it's part of an ongoing investigation. Because, as you mentioned, the press, I know they can be kind of get in the way a lot, you know, having been in the press myself, they can get away a lot. But on the other hand, as you know, the press sometimes is the reason you have cases to try, is because of the good work they do as the fourth
Correct.
State. So there's that balance at all times, you know, to be able to do that. And I would just, you know, encourage you to, you know, as you work on, you know, perhaps legislative conference concepts from your office or my colleagues, is to look at, you know, can we more clearly define what might be the parameters so that we don't, because of a particular case, set a policy that may not be in the public interest overall.
Senator, I think that's a very fine suggestion.
Any additional questions for the Attorney General or the staff he has brought?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, and thank you for taking this on. It was one of my goals. Before I became chair of the committee I'm chair of now, I was chair of Judiciary, and it was one of my goals to take that on, and it's much better seated in your office with the kind of expertise that you have. And I actually was a co-plaintiff in one of the first, if not the first, lawsuit under the public meetings law. And it was successful because of a creative judge, a creative legislature, not because of any sanctions in the law. And I'm just wondering if you're taking a look at the penalty structure in the law, because as I recall, having been in court on it, there really wasn't much in the way of actual penalties.
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, we are looking very closely at that issue. I think the challenge on penalties is a conflict. On the one hand, if you've got a penalty like a fine for violations of transparency laws, that certainly provides an incentive for people to be more transparent. On the other hand, if there's a fine or penalty involved, it may delay a lot of disclosures and may raise the costs, because some government officials will be uncomfortable making a disclosure decision that could result in a penalty, or a decision not to disclose that could result in a penalty, unless they get advice of counsel. And it is often consulting lawyers that drives up the cost of compliance with the public records request.
Okay.
And so the challenge is to balance those two. And that's something the three of us, as we work on this legislative proposal, have gone back and forth. And I can't say that I think we've reached 100% consensus, but that's the balance.
Yeah, and that's a balance, and that's, I mean, obviously the public records law, which I've worked with quite a bit as well, is very complex and very ambiguous in places. I'm glad you're dealing with that. But my question really went to the open meetings law.
Oh.
Because, you know, there was really no penalty for, you know, a quorum of a committee, in this case, getting together to, you know, talk about strategy in violation of the law. There really wasn't much of a sanction there at all. And again, it had a very happy ending. It's how we got the constitutional amendment applying the open meeting law to the legislature. That was the trade-off devised by a very creative judge. So in that case, it had a happy ending, but in general, there's really no sanction.
Senator, that's a very good point. And if I could, why don't myself and Mr. Crone come and pay you a visit, and we can have a further discussion about that.
Perfect. Thanks.
Mr. Attorney General, I had a comment and a sort of a question also. Give you a couple of examples. I can clearly understand of when there is an ongoing investigation why some internal documents would not be disclosed because of the ongoing investigation and probably trying to interview witnesses first and trying to determine what the actual facts are. Ultimately, though, if those are public documents, I would assume that after the investigation that most of those items should be public. And I'm putting this in reference to, like, for a city council, they might... The only exception to this I know of is probably in the personnel area, where you would not actually probably publicly disclose the reasons for someone's dismissal. depending upon the circumstances. But if you were in real estate negotiations or if you were in collective bargaining negotiations, ultimately, whatever agreements you reached, you would come out of the executive session, you would ratify, and that or not ratify, and that agreement would be subject to full disclosure. Now, I want to make this a little bit cloudier, though. These are actually public entities, obviously, universities, but if you're conducting research and you have a grant for that research, and with the mechanisms that we have now and mechanisms many states have now, the university and the public can benefit from that research not only because of the benefits of the research, but financially benefit. It presents a gray area in which I don't know what the determination would be about how much you would have to disclose. Can you comment a little bit about the gray areas in some of this?
I will take a stab, Senator Devlin, and then if Michael has any additional comments, I'd solicit them. I would say that the question of what is required to be disclosed and what is exempt under trade secret laws, in particular in joint ventures that a private enterprise might have with the state university, a lot of that does come down to balancing of public interests. And there's going to be a lot of very strong incentives for particularly intellectual property that's under development, for example, not to be disclosed to the public in order to give the private entity and the university the ability to continue with their project. The Nike contract was a little bit unique in that the university believed somehow it would harm the university's competitive position in the sports marketing world to disclose the terms of the contract. But when I asked Mr. Krohn to survey other state universities, they not only disclosed their contracts but bragged about them, so that you could go to the University of Texas or the University of North Carolina, big public universities with big sports programs, and there was complete transparency about their relationship with Nike. And once we ordered the contract disclosed, we discovered there was nothing unique or unusual about that contract in the least. It wasn't extraordinarily large. It wasn't extraordinarily small. There weren't any bizarre, unique terms. I think that's an example where we were being non-transparent, even though there really wasn't much of a reason not to be more transparent. People were more concerned because we weren't disclosing information that there might be something of public interest that was secret. And once the contract was disclosed, all the furor died off. So I think the gray area comes from that balancing, which is very hard to do. But obviously, it's something that I think, you know, the laws required us to do, and I think we can do it competently. We're certainly not interested in making it providing disincentives for public-private partnerships or economic development activities at the universities. I don't know if...
Senator Devlin, or Chair Devlin, I guess. I guess the only thing I would add to that is I think that the gray area of the public interest balancing is something that I would be really reluctant to get rid of, frankly. I think that there may be a particular issue with a particular contract where we feel like the public really ought to know what's going on, and there may be particular information in that contract that that we feel the same way about. Bottom line money coming into the state university system, I think there's always going to be a pretty strong public interest in seeing where the university is getting its funds and how much. And frankly, the same with money going out of the university. And I guess I'd put that at one end of the spectrum, and then the other issues I think maybe would need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, which is what the law allows.
For the sake of the audience, this is actually an informational meeting, not a public hearing. So you look like you have a question, Senator Ferriol.
Why, you're so perceptive, Mr. Thank you. I have a question about the policy of, I guess what I call the designation of executive privilege. I think folks are aware of the Brent Foster termination. And the questions that attended that generated a whole slew of information requests from press and even members of the legislature, myself included. And what's interesting to me is that in the attempt to protect the rights of Mr. Foster and to preserve the opportunity to more deeply investigate the issue, the question of whether or not persons are within the AG's office may or may not have acted in a manner injurious to the administrative rights of parties to permits, for instance, in the Bradwood Landing issue, with other linear facilities, with the development of a city property that happens to be located in Washington State, owned by the city of the Dalles, and a whole bunch of other related issues. And there's been some speculation about what role Mr. Foster may have had in those instances and what was the chain of command within the agency. All of those reasons for non-disclosure are easy to understand, but the byproduct of that non-disclosure is that we really can't get any answers. It leaves a whole bunch of unanswered questions relative to how Mr. Foster conducted his activities within the agency and who supervised him and what was the level of communication on other issues besides the one issue that everybody seems to be aware of, and that's the juice case up in Hood River. So I guess I'd love to hear your comment on
sure.
When might we expect disclosure, and does the designation of a special prosecutor, in this case a judge in Marion County, put a lockbox on all the information that might be ancillary or not even related to the case at hand?
Sure. Chair Devlin, Senator Ferrioli, the Foster situation, I think most people are aware of. We were investigating Hood River Juice, a company that was alleged to have polluted in violation of the laws. The company has pled guilty, as you're aware. In the process of that, Mr. Foster made false statements to government investigators about taking a water sample. He claimed that someone else had taken a water sample when he had done that personally. He resigned from my office on the day that he notified me of this misstatement, and that day I requested that the Marion County District Attorney open up a criminal investigation, which is underway. We've received, I believe, 34 different public records requests with respect to Mr. Foster. They cover virtually every single document he might have seen or touched during his time at the Department of Justice. It is a number of documents in the tens of thousands. Before the criminal investigation was triggered, we had responded to and provided as many documents as we were legally entitled to provide. The documents that we did not provide were covered by attorney-client privilege asserted by parties other than the state of Oregon. That's not something that I can waive. Were I to disclose those documents, I would be subject to discipline by the bar and possibly disbarment, which certainly is an obligation I intend to follow. The requests that we received that fall after the date of the criminal investigation or that we had not yet complied with are affected by a request we have from the Marion County District Attorney, which is not to disclose those records until the termination of their investigation. I have no information about the status of their investigation. I've had no contact with the District Attorney about this case since the day in which I requested the criminal investigation. We are internally reviewing all the documents with respect to privilege issues and other legal issues so that they are ready to be disclosed at the moment we receive word from the Marion County District Attorney that they feel disclosure of those records will have no impact on their criminal investigation. I can't tell you, I have no information to provide about the timing of the Marion County District Attorney's investigation, but I can tell you that a very large volume of those records are ready to be disclosed literally within 24 hours of the Marion County District Attorney informing us that it's appropriate to do so. The other thing I would tell you is we ordered an internal review which is being done by Judge Koch, the former chief judge of the Multnomah County Circuit Court, to review every aspect of Mr. Foster's work at the Department of Justice. And that report, too, will be available to the public as soon as the Marion County District Attorney has terminated their investigation. So I hate to tell you that you're waiting for records, and I understand that, and we will get them to you as soon as we're given the green light from the District Attorney.
Mr. Chair, just a brief follow-up. You mentioned the third parties that are claiming exemption from disclosure by virtue of attorney-client privilege. Is it permissible for us to know who these folks are who are claiming that they have a privileged relationship with the Attorney General's office?
It's a small number of entities that are co-parties. Some of them are other governmental entities. Some of them are nonprofits that were in effect in a joint defense arrangement with the state of Oregon. In the case in question, which is the Ninth Circuit case involving the FERC approval of a liquefied natural gas terminal, the court ordered all of the parties to participate together in joint briefing, and as a result, under the legal ethics rules, we have an obligation to them not to disclose information that we exchanged as part of that. I would have to go back and look if there's any legal prohibition on sharing what entities those are, so I will do that, and if it is ethically allowed to provide that information, I'll provide it to your office.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the concern that I have is, and I think it deserves more exploration, and perhaps we'll see it in the development of the policy, the disclosure policy, is that governmental entities, having engaged in defense of themselves using the same legal counsel, which would be the Attorney General's office, may be able to protect each other from disclosure by simply claiming attorney-client privilege on a wide variety of their communications. This is not disclosure. This is the opposite of disclosure. This is governmental entities finding, you know, what appears to be an ethical justification for stonewalling basic disclosures. And I don't think the public regards that as acceptable. I certainly don't. And the other issue is certain nonprofits, if the state has a political agenda that it's operating through the Attorney General's office, then one party to this, or a group of parties to this political agenda, might be able to claim attorney privilege and therefore run an agenda essentially sort of under the radar. And there's a great deal of suspicion about the issue of Bradwood Landing. If you just step back and look at the time that process took, the expense, the number of applications and appeals to applications, and the question, you know, is the Attorney General's office operating as an honest broker to determine the legalities of the state positions, or is it in fact a participant with an objective, in this case, of preventing the development of the process, of the project? So the disclosure of these documents being hindered by the concept of the expansion of the whole attorney-client privilege relationship seems to me to be utterly antithetical to the public interest. So, you know, having said that, I'd love to hear your reaction, but I also want to encourage you to take a very circumspect view of what the attorney-client privilege really covers, and whether or not there is sufficient mutual interest to invoke attorney-client privilege. Those issues, I think, speak to the very heart of ethicality in the way the AG's office is being operated.
Mr. Attorney General, if you would please respond, and then we will probably have to get on to the next subject, because soon this room will fill up with lots of people waiting to be interviewed.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, if I may. In this particular case, the reason there exists an attorney-client privilege that is shared between the state of Oregon and other entities is not because we agreed to a joint defense agreement, but were ordered by the court to participate in joint briefing. This is a very standard procedure from courts that want to aggregate all of the parties on one side of a lawsuit and hear from them through one brief. And it is a lock-solid principle of American professional legal ethics that once that has occurred, the parties exchanging information pursuant to court order have ethical responsibilities to one another. I would very much love to waive the privilege and provide those documents, but I am simply not allowed to do so. Were I to do so, I would be subject to discipline by the bar for violating American professional ethics. That is not a question of stonewalling. It is a question of following the legal ethics that apply to the profession. With respect to whether a political agenda drove the lawsuit in question, I would simply say that the lawsuit in question is pending in front of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The Oregon Department of Justice is representing a client, which is the governor and the state of Oregon, and there's been utter transparency with respect to the arguments that were raised. We're either right or wrong in that lawsuit, and the U.S. Court of Appeals will tell us whether we are right or wrong when it adjudicates the claim.
Mr. Chair, I know you want to move on, and I appreciate that. Can I ask one other issue?
Yes.
I'd like to get the feedback on the record with the Attorney General. My business committee held hearings a couple of months ago, and one of the topics was the Oregon Arena Project, and I'm sure you're aware of some of those, and it was very, very disheartening that the lack of information that the university even had on some of the contracting that was being done on that project. And they have moved forward on their own transparency initiative to provide public records, and we'll see how that works. But my bigger concern is that in terms of trying to avoid the public contracting law and the public records law, and I hate to, I don't want to pin on the university because it's, most these are donor funds, okay? And we really appreciate that, the great, effort that people make to support higher education. But since that time, one or perhaps two other parcels of land in a direct effort to avoid the public records law, has leased that to a private citizen who is building a project, and then will give it back to the university so that there is no public disclosure of the process and the contracting that goes on in that. Even though, as we have since learned on some of those projects, part of the requirements are that for donating money to build a project requires, as part of that agreement, to actually hire a certain amount of staffing per student, which then becomes an obligation ongoing for the state funding of these staffs for the donations that require the building. And I just would like to have your reaction because, again, we're looking at one instance, but this could be certainly multiplied in other instances as ways to avoid public disclosure, public contracting, and public records. Is this a proper thing, do you believe? And if not, what can this body do to avoid a direct effort to try and avoid public disclosure?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, it's a totally appropriate question. I hate to sound like a lawyer, but I don't want to opine off the cuff about the potential application of the public records laws to what is an extraordinarily complex transaction. And so what I would propose, if it's acceptable to you, is for Mr. Crone and myself to set up a time to come by your office, get a little more facts about some of the things that concern you, and then do a little legal work before we give you a reaction.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to move on to the next item on the agenda, an update on the Oregon Government Ethics Commission as a guide for public officials. Mr. Biggs, the chair of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and Lynn Rosick, the assistant attorney general, I believe, assigned to the commission.
Good afternoon. I'm Charles Biggs, chairman of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and this is Lynn Rosick, Assistant Attorney General, that came with me. You folks want an update on our manual, and you want some reaction probably to your letter finding some of it wanting.
Okay. Maybe I should explain to the committee, because maybe the committee doesn't know
ahead.
About
yeah.
the joint letter. As the committee is well aware, this committee spent, I think, almost 4 months revising the ethics laws after the passage of SB 10, which ultimately became SB 30, trying to simplify both the administration and the impact on public officials in terms of clarifying how they will meet the requirements in the ethics laws. We received an early draft of the, close to final draft, of the guide for public officials. Here you see it. It's you have a copy of it. And Representative Roblin's and my reaction was similar. We were trying to clarify things for public officials, making it easier for them to comply, and trying to think in terms of public officials that are public officials, like the situation that we're in, where we actually have legal counsel immediately available to us, and where we can consult with that counsel, all the way to the planning commissioner out in a small city, whether it's rural or not rural, or a city councilor in a small city, or a special district board member in a special district, being able to understand this process. And I think we found the complexity of the document that was produced as the guide as actually making it probably less understandable for public officials what the ethics laws were of the state, rather than more. And so we asked, we sent a letter to the commission asking them to re-examine. We got a letter back from the director basically saying that if Representative Roblin and I or other members of the legislature wanted to rewrite the manual or suggest changes to it, we could. We responded to that by saying basically that that's not our role. We passed the statute. It's the role of the Ethics Commission to put in place the administrative rules and to do the manual in an understandable fashion. I might hearken back to the days when I was first a public official, and one of the former directors, and I think it's still a common responsibility, would come to like a League of Oregon Cities meeting and try to explain the ethics laws of the states to a lot of lay people, actually, that maybe for the first time were elected to an office, or maybe they're a planning commission and they got a commissioner and they got invited to one of these meetings. And we're just trying to find some ways to make this clearer to public officials, to make it less complex, and at all times trying to ensure that they comply with the statute. And I think that's where we came from in terms of our letter. And obviously, our desire would be that the commission would find some way to make the manual easier for people to use. I mean, you might be able to do some things in terms of to approach it as a public official might, or to basically try to get into situations where they would understand more clearly what the ethical ramifications are. I think all of us that have been elected to positions here underlying this, even without a statute and without administrative rules and without a manual, we kind of have an underlying feeling of when some things are questionable and when they're not questionable. I mean, if I was a city councilor out there, I think it would be relatively reasonable for me if the city council was going to give a contract to my brother Joe. I don't actually have a brother Joe. But that he was the most responsive bidder, and that I'd probably check with whoever was the city administrator, city manager, or council, and just make sure that everything is literally on the up and up. We're just trying to basically do, I think, the same thing that the Ethics Commission is trying to do, and that is to make this more understandable to the literally thousands of public officials that have to comply with it.
Sure. Let me start with your reference from your administrator about why we set the consideration of this over to the next meeting. We met on September 8th, shortly after Labor Day. So your letter came in the day before the meeting. Some stakeholders, at least the city of Portland, sent a letter in that was hand-delivered the day before the meeting after the holiday. And your letter expressed concern that we were going to hurry up and get this done before your meeting date today, I think. I would have had no intention as chair of adopting that manual at that meeting when the commission This is really rewrite two, the one before you today. The commission hadn't gotten that until late in the week before our meeting, and we didn't see your letters till the day before. So, you know, I feel as chairman, I think the commission does too, that we need to get this out. The law's been, the changes have been in effect a while, but we've got to get out an understandable and useful thing. There's no point in doing it. The commission had a consensus, really, that we put it over to the next meeting and do some more drafting and work on it. We instructed the director to, as I recall, I think Commissioner Campbell brought it up, but ask him to contact you and see if you had any specific suggestions. I wouldn't frame it at all as rewriting the manual. I haven't seen the letter to you. But it's either to deal with specifics. But I understand your general overall concerns. I went through the manual when I got it. It's nearly 50 pages, I think. I've got suggestions. I've done a bit of scratching and editing on it, and I've done quite a lot of editing in my past life, so I think I could probably shorten it by 15% without losing any details of it. I told the director, we met the day before the meeting, that I thought it was too long and repetitious in some places and needed to be reworked. And I think the sense of the commission is that we're going to do a redraft. Of course, we'll send that out to the interest groups and send it to you folks as well prior to our next meeting, which is in late October, 26th, I believe. But let me mention one of the things that's tough is, of course, there were a bunch of changes to the law. One of the things I noticed in the manual, just in a quick example, and that I've talked to the director about is, he and I think we need to try to draw a bright line, for example, between the gift law and the use of office law. And that's a kind of a tough thing to do. And we're trying to do that in the manual. I don't think it's as clear as it might be. But I think that's something that commonly would come up to a public official. You mentioned putting yourself in the shoes. I thought that I should try to be the mayor of Ione in reading this manual and trying to decide what to do in a certain circumstance. Another thing we've run into is the interest groups. We've got examples in the manual. For each cities, counties, special districts, maybe, of what can and can't be done. They don't sometimes want their own interest group to be an example. Well, I think examples are critical. And these examples, I think probably, I haven't talked to them at length, but I think Ron drew these from past cases, probably, or cases we've handled. And if we can't reduce this to on-the-ground examples, I don't think we're being very helpful to the officials. You mentioned that it sounds a little too legal and complex, and so I asked Lynn if she'd make a brief comment or two about that. She's been more involved in the drafting of it. The commission really isn't involved in the internal drafting until we see it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
As a former member of Associated Press, I was disappointed to hear you say you could only reduce this by 15%.
Well, I that's my first trial.
I would suggest you convene a meeting of the AP Alumni Society.
You want to attend?
I'd be happy to.
I remember your open meeting victory, by the way.
Thank you.
That's a long time ago.
I think that shows both of our age.
No, I remember it, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, I'm Lynn Rosick, and I've represented the Ethics Commission for a number of years now. And, you know, I may have to take some blame, I guess, for some of the complexity in this. It would be lovely if we could just write it in, you know, in crystal clarity. It would lose a lot of the precision that the statute itself has. And so there's a tension that I feel, at least, in that you know, between the simplifying and the actually capturing what the statute requires. And so, I mean, I completely agree with you on the goal of having it be simple. Now, I would say that some parts of the manual really have not been changed all that much because some parts of the statute were not changed in either 2007 or 2009. So, I mean, I brought along, for those of you who remember, the lime green copy that the commission used to print for people. This was the, like, the little Bible of the 90s. This was printed in 1993. The Ethics Commission no longer prints copies. They just put it online. But some parts of this are still in the latest version, so it hasn't all been changed. But for the parts that were changed, it's been important, I think, for people to recognize that there are a number of very precise exceptions now, for example, to the gift statute, that need to have some detail to them so that you know what the elements are. I'm not trying to excuse the parts where I know it's harder to read than it should be, but the statute sometimes isn't quite as simple as to be able to be captured in pure layman's terms.
Well, I think what Representative Roblin and I were trying to get to was basically that we felt in both of our cases that our committees had spent major amounts of time and resources trying to basically simplify the statute, make it easier to comply with, and we were hoping that in this guide that would be a similar effort. I recognize clearly that you have to explain some of the complexities, but a person that's walking into this as a volunteer planning commissioner shouldn't actually be presented either with the Internal Revenue Code and asked to understand every aspect of the Internal Revenue Code. I mean, I think that there should be some way to walk through the door and just understand some of the basic principles so that a person looking at the guide could understand some of the basic principles, even if they didn't understand every single example, many of which they would probably never, even if they served on the Planning Commission for 20 years, never come into contact with an issue that was similar. That's what we're trying to look for, basically. And so,
I appreciate that. And we're doing our best.
Yeah.
Let me say, too, that the law has gotten lengthened and the manual's gotten lengthened.
Yeah.
I think it's a little too long, but there's a tension also between oversimplifying a complicated matter. And
yeah.
I think your letter said your goal is to reduce inquiries to lawyers for local governments and to our staff. But that tension is if we go too far toward the simplification edge, we'll get more inquiries to the lawyers and to the staff. And the staff's there to do it, and we get a lot of inquiries and answer them, but they have other things to do as well. So that's a worthy goal, but just a thought. Now, I'll just summarize and answer any other questions, but if we're going to take another run at it, we'll get a draft around before the 26th of October, and if we think it's satisfactory, then we may go ahead with it. If we don't, we won't.
Okay.
I'm not in a rush.
Mr. Beggs, are you actively soliciting additional comments from entities like the League of Oregon Cities?
I believe so, yes.
Oregon Counties.
I believe so, yes.
And
We will, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we will.
Any questions?
No, just actually a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
It's just going to be fascinating to watch folks essentially lay the blame for the complications that the legislature engendered in the ethics law on the committee that's writing the clarifications. You know, it's going to be really interesting to be able to point to Mr. Beggs and say, well, it's his fault. Legislators probably overreacted when we responded to what was perceived to be a provocation in the form of an opportunity, political opportunity, to do some chest beating on ethical issues. And the collateral damage that we did caused resignation, mass resignations, and, further alienation of citizens from their government. And, you know, we've tried to ameliorate that with,
yeah,
this, with revisiting some of the most egregious issues. And, you know, clarifications, I think, would just invite people to take another look at it, and it'll be interesting to see what their reactions will be. But personally, I'm going to blame Mr. Beggs for the whole disaster.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Forever. I agreed to be chairman.
That's why he makes the big bucks.
But I think Mr. Beggs, when he was with the AP, got the blame, too.
Quite often. But I need to earn my $30 a meeting.
But I think Senator Farioli and I actually do agree in many ways on this. We were left with a statute that had been produced in a previous session, which we think caused major problems throughout the state. Some of the aspects of that statute not particularly well thought out, and we had to go back and to rewrite portions of that statute. And, I mean, it doesn't mean that it's the last time it'll have to be rewritten. I would mention to people that we largely chose to go back and to rewrite those portions that we found most egregious. But the reality is that the entire statute, we didn't tackle the entire statute. We only tackled those areas that we thought were egregious. The entire statute is in itself extremely complex and relatively confusing. But that would be a task for probably another committee for another session, for a very long session, to be able to basically to make that as clarified as we would like it to be. But I do appreciate you both coming here today.
Well, Senator Devlin, let me say, too, maybe I'm closing, but I take the manual seriously. I think it's our most important publication by far. And another thing is it can protect officials if we adopt it as a commission advisory opinion, which has been done sometimes in the past. If they follow in good faith, then we can't go after them. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
To that comment, I will guarantee you that in every legislator's office there is a well-thumbed copy of the manual. It's probably the document that gets referred to very late at night after a piece of registered mail arrives and of a complaint gets filed. In the best of circumstances, well before any of those things.
Well, it's got to be useful for people in government at all levels, obviously.
Well, thank you both for coming
here today.
Sure.
We're now going to go on to our final informational, and then we'll get to the executive appointments. Citizen Initiative Review Project, House Bill 2895. Mr. Shuford and Mr. Reitman.
Participants from the Citizens Initiative Review as well.
Okay, please just have one or both of them. One can sit up here and one can sit behind, and or at the edge. That'll be fine. And we're going to try to finish this by 2:20 so we can get to the executive appointments. So,
okay.
I know there may be some questions and some comments.
In the interest of in time, we may not show a video that Representative Berger said explains it better than we do. So,
okay, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Elliot Shuford. I'm a co-director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Citizens Initiative Review again with this committee. Briefly, some background. Just a little bit of background about our organization. Thank you. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that's been working to promote the Citizens Initiative Review since 2007. We did a successful field test of the process in 2008, and then following that, in 2009, we worked with the legislature to pass House Bill 2895, which created an opportunity for a full-scale pilot of the Citizens Initiative Review. We worked with members of this committee, as well as others in the legislature. And then we just implemented that pilot, and we'll have an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that. I wanted to just remind the committee exactly what the Citizens Initiative Review is before we got into any of those details. The goal of the Citizens Initiative Review is it's an innovative reform which provides voters with clear, useful, and trustworthy evaluations of statewide ballot measures. just a few of the basics. For each measure that's reviewed, a panel of 24 randomly selected registered voters that are demographically balanced in a panel hear balanced hearings from the proponents of a measure, the opponents of a measure, as well as a list of background presenters or witnesses. They, at the end of the process, they issue a citizen statement, which is a one-page evaluation that lists the reasons to support the measure, the reasons to oppose the measure, a section of key findings, and then any sort of a shared agreement or a consensus statement that the panel would like to make. That's all on one concise page called the Citizen Statement per House Bill 2895. That will be published in a new place in the voters' pamphlet, so it's accessible to all voters throughout the state. We're also in the process of developing an online archive of all documents and presentations that were given to the panel so that members of the media, interested members of the public, have access to all of the information that went to the panel.
So, Chair Devlin, Tyrone Reitman, Director of Healthy Democracy Oregon. The purpose of House Bill 2895 was really to provide voters the opportunity to take a look at the information that comes from the review process for themselves. So it allowed for the results to be published as a prominent new page in the voters' pamphlet. The other goal of the legislation was to really determine through an evaluation if voters see this information, use it, trust it, and determine what the impact is, and ultimately whether or not this is a valuable public service to all Oregon voters. The National Science Foundation in November, December of 2009 provided a $220,000 research grant to take a look how voters use this information. And that evaluation is being conducted right now with a sample going out to see how voters view the information currently available about ballot measures. And then once the voters pamphlet comes out, whether or not the statement from this review process has a positive impact. As Elliot mentioned, two reviews were conducted. The first review was of Measure 73 that took place in the second week of August here in Salem. A panel of 24 people from across the state got to hear from advocates both for and against that measure. The following week, a review of Measure 74 took place that deals with legalizing medical marijuana dispensaries. And another new panel of 24 voters got to hear the pros and cons and call upon background experts to have their questions answered. Following those reviews, there was a lot of really positive press coverage that came out, ranging from the LeGrand Observer to the Oregonian to the Daily Historian and publications around the state. And so what we're waiting for next really is to see the results of the evaluation come out in determining our next steps. We have with us today two panelists, Marion Sharp, who participated in the review of Measure 73, and Greg Casimir, who participated in the review of Measure 74. And we could talk and talk about this, but we'd love to have the opportunity for them to speak in their own words to you and to answer your questions about that experience. And then following that, we'd like to take any questions you may have. There's one more slide. So.
One other piece to just briefly mention is in 2011 we are planning to work on legislation that would create an independent commission within the executive branch to oversee future citizens' initiative reviews. The goal there would to have a commission that's balanced by former panelists, former moderators, and then fifth members of explanatory statement committees. So there's a mix of expertise with respect to the initiative process and those intimately involved with the Citizens Initiative Review to provide trustworthy oversight of the process in the future. An important note that we should highlight is also that we would see pursuing funding through grants and individual contributions and not expend state funds to fund those future reviews. And this is all pending the evaluation of the Citizens Initiative Review to see that it's indeed a valued public service and accessed and utilized by voters throughout the state.
Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Marion Sharp from Tigard, Oregon. And as they said, I was part of the first group, Measure 73. I am 62, and I would have to say that personally, as a citizen, this was probably the most positive, powerful, hopeful experience that I've ever had. to see a group of 24 randomly selected citizens come together, how seriously everyone took the charge that we were given, how carefully everyone thought about the measures and asked the questions. It was a phenomenal experience. I just, we had someone who was 19, someone who was in their 80s, someone who had a GED, someone who had PhDs. It didn't matter. Everyone contributed in a significant and valuable way to the whole process. And I could not have told you what political position they hold outside of this. It was not a partisan kind of a conversation. It was truly remarkable. And if you ever have a chance to witness it, I would highly encourage you to do that. It's really phenomenal.
And please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Greg Cashmere, C-A-Z-E-M-I-E-R, Chairman Devlin and the committee. It's an opportunity to read your junk mail. Got a letter saying something about the Oregon Healthy Democracy. And normally I would have thrown it in the mail, just thrown it in the junk. But the Healthy Democracy just seemed really interesting to me. So I filled out the application and sent it in. We got to the place. There's 24 people from the diverse backgrounds, from a high school, from a person just getting out of high school and going to college, to retired people like myself. The staff was real hospitable in teaching us how to run this thing effectively in a time manner and to keep on track. We were treated like kings. What I really liked about the process was we got to ask witnesses questions directly. There were on pro and con on the situation. And then we got to dig deep and to find out if that information was factual, it was biased, where it came from, if it was an error in some way or another, or less credible than the other information. What I noticed was both sides want to take statistics and try to twist them to make them meet what they want them to meet. And we were able to actually break those down and look at them in depth and as a group sit around and discuss that. We came up with some really, I think, neat facts on both sides. And that's what we were looking for, was the facts, not the opinions or the biases or the emotion that went with it. We're looking for the credibility of the witnesses. And what we did, the most unique thing about this whole thing is we worked as a team, whether you were pro or con at the end of it. We helped each other without bias of, I'm not going to help you because you're on that side, I'm not going to help you because you're on that side. It was like we sat down and we took the fact sheets and we worked together and wordsmithed them and tried to get them so they were factual and complete in their entities. These 125 word documents that will be in the voter's pamphlet took the highlights, but it doesn't capture all the facts. But my hope is that the voters will read those facts, it'll get their attention, and they'll want to dig deeper and find out, are we credible in what we wrote? Is that factual? And they'll dig deeper and be more educated when they go to the ballots, to the polls to vote, the post to vote. But anyway, just want to read this one thing that I wrote when I was this morning. And it said, the value and the results... I'm going to throw my glasses on here for a second. The snapshot of the most valuable information we discovered will be available for all voters in Oregon, and the complete process is available on the website for their review. Hopefully this information will encourage voters to look deeper into their questions raised by the information we developed over the week. In summation, that's really where my heart was, is to hopefully we'll get the voters interested in these ballot measures. I'd love to be able to have a group of people that can firsthand see the emotion of these people that wrote these ballot measures. They're obviously very impacted by the measures that they've written. We had people on our panel that were actually crying, that were actually not on our panel, but on the people, the writers and the petitioners that actually wrote the ballot measure. There was a lot of emotion, and it was just nice to see that firsthand. It's kind of hard to read that. But digging deep and looking on both sides, I can't say that I changed my opinion, but I took my opinion and changed it from being a little doubtful, not knowing which way I'd go, to being rock solid in my opinion. So I think the education has enlightened me to look further into ballot measures in the future, to study more. I know the other panel, when they wrote their ballot measure, my original thought was the opposite, or they came out really lopsided. It's going to make me really take a good, strong look at that particular ballot measure. How can this benefit Oregon? This is just kind of my opinion. It is a powerful process designed for citizens to set out to search out the values and the pitfalls of ballot measures and get that information out to the voters. And Oregon Healthy Democracy has a website. The information is going to be in the voters' pamphlet. And I personally can't talk to my friends without sharing this opportunity. I'm passionate about my beliefs on this particular ballot measure that I sat on, more so than I have on any ballot measure that I've ever voted on. I think that's incredible by itself. And I started out and thought about, how do I feel about initiatives in voting? And I started out thinking, man, that's a great concept, initiatives. And the more I thought about it and pondered on it, I kind of came up that they're really expensive. They're driven by special interest groups to achieve a desired goal. And my questions were, are the rights of others being properly considered when we develop a ballot measure? Are we looking out just for our desires, or are we really looking at other people's rights and justice, in short? It seems like it skips the due process by elected officials and the possibility of just continually running ballot measures until they pass. I've heard a comment at my local church the other day, and a real good friend of mine looked at me and said, well, I don't know why we just don't pass it. I'm getting tired of hearing about it. You know, and I think we're sometimes softened to issues when we hear them over and over and over and over again. And I really respect what you people do. I believe in the legislature and the legislative assembly. I think I'd like to see a lot more of these bills be seen by you. And you should be making the decision, in my personal opinion, of whether or not they make the ballot or they don't make the ballot. But that's just my opinion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick, and we're going to spend about 8 more minutes on this.
Okay, could I ask you, are you able to say which one you worked on?
Sure.
Measure 74, the marijuana initiative.
Oh, okay, because I've read the news coverage on that one and the mandatory sentencing one, and I was just really struck, even at just what came out in the newspaper, and how thoughtful a process it looked like. I mean, it really kind of emerged from these stories how thoroughly you looked into this and how seriously you took the mission. So I really want to thank you for devoting the time. I'm so glad it was such an inspiring situation for you, because that, as a great believer in democracy, I'm thrilled by that.
Chairman Devlin, can I just comment? It was a lot like taking a college class. I had 2 notebooks about this size with material highlighted, little posties in them, things divided out so you could get back to find them and stuff. I mean, it was literally as intense as taking a college class for a week. Most of the people, I think, studied at night. Several of us met after hours and before hours to wordsmith things so we could get the process done. So the people who were there, even though the vast backgrounds that they came from, there wasn't a person there that wasn't excited to be there, enthusiastic about the project, and wanting to help each other regardless of what side of the issue they were on.
That's terrific.
Yes.
Senator Devlin, Senator Burdick, all of the committee members. One of the things that we did, we studied, we have binders of material, and at one point we did some searches to see if there was other information out there, and one of the things that I discovered is that within that first day, we had raised some significant questions that we had concerns about for the particular initiative that we were working on. And that was, you know, hearing the initial presentation and just thinking about this as people who were committed to being there. And when I did the review and did the search, I was finding studies done in other states and in Oregon, and people who had been studying the issue for a long time, they came up with the same questions that we did after months of working on it. And we were able to see those questions and raise them from the beginning and then continue to explore those, ask the questions, get the information during the course of a week. But that was really encouraging to me that you know, we nailed those right from the beginning.
Any additional comments or questions? Yes, Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, thanks for the work. I think the experience must have been extraordinary. At least it seems to me that that's what's happening here. On 73, did anybody here work on 73? Okay. Some of the language in the statements opposed, which was apparently agreed to by 21 of the panelists, are diametrically opposed to statements that were made in the statement written by the three panelists who were in favor of the measure. So when you've got two groups of folks, regardless of what the numbers are, and they just absolutely are issuing statements that cannot be reconciled, how does that help the voter? And let me read the statement. I think that might help the question. Longer mandatory sentences have little or no effect as a deterrent. And that's a statement made by the folks in opposition. The folks that supported the measure said, "State statistics support that mandatory sentencing is effective on reduction of violent crime." So you've got lay people essentially having studied the measure, offering absolutely opposing viewpoints. How does that help the voter?
We'll just take a stab at that. So thank you for the question, Senator Devlin, Senator Ferrioli. It would have been easier if you'd used a couple other examples. I would have had a quicker response to that. When we listened to and called for testimony from expert witnesses, we asked questions that ask, you know, does the mandatory sentencing make a difference? And I think there may have been some differences kind of in how we were phrasing it. So if you continue to add on to that mandatory sentencing, they're not showing any kind of statistical or other evidence that it helps in any way. You know, obviously, if you've got someone behind bars, they can't reoffend. But does it actually change the outcome? So it was two groups who were free to write their statements as they chose and as they heard the information. And I think that that's a fair circumstance. And perhaps that would send someone who is on one side or the other to say, I need to dig a little bit deeper because here's a pro and a con, and they're saying what seems to be the opposite of that. That may not be the best answer, but that's what I've got right now.
I'm just trying to follow
up.
The in Measure 73, the randomly selected panelists numbering 24 resulted in a 21-3 split. And, you know, I think just that may have an effect on how people are affected by the work of the commission. On the other issue, on the Measure 74, there wasn't what I'd call a convincing majority position, or an overwhelming majority position. Of 24 panelists, 13 were in favor of the measure, 11 were opposed. If one person's opinion had changed, you'd have had a deadlock 12-12. And I just wonder, you know, does this become a mini election rather than an attempt to explain, you know, from average voters' perspective, what the measure does?
Please proceed, and then we are going to have to go on.
Chairman Devlin and committee, I think it's interesting that it came out 50-50 split. I mean, basically 13-11, I'd say it's just half and half. I think you're right on that line. The issue is, for the voters, is the fact-finding. We broke down the facts, and ethically, morally, people are going to have to make a decision of where they stand on that thing. Sympathetically, looking at the witnesses that came in wheelchairs and were crippled up, you wouldn't deny them morphine. You would absolutely give them whatever medication it took to make them comfortable. The question is, in my opinion, is to look at the facts and analyze, should Oregon be exceeding federal law? Is the ballot measure written where it is enforceable? Is it well worded? And if you look at the fact finding, both sides completely agreed in a joint statement that it's poorly written. The panelists that testified before us agreed that it's poorly written. It cannot be enforced under the current way that it's written by district attorneys, by all the people that presented evidence to us. Neither side disagreed with that. The people that actually wrote the ballot measure apologized for the way it was written, but they said, that's the way laws are written. There are no perfect laws. Now, I believe that thou shalt not commit murder is a perfect law. Thou shalt not steal is a perfect law. There are many, many great laws that are easily discernible, easily understood. And I have a lot of empathy for the people that are in pain, and I wouldn't deny them anything to help them with their pain. But right now, Oregon has gone from what they said was going to be approximately 500 medical marijuana cards to over 40,000 right now. And to me, the way this thing is written, where felons can, within 5 years of their conviction, can go forward and be a grower, a distributor, a transporter, a seller of marijuana in the state of Oregon, said a lot to me about the credibility of the whole procedure. They wanted to say ex-felons, they've done their time, but in my opinion, there's no such thing as an ex-felon. Once you're a convicted felon, you are a felon. So I think if they look at the facts, search their hearts, the information that's in there, I think they need to check it out and make sure it's credible. We did everything we could to do to try to find out which witnesses were credible, which ones had an agenda, and we tried to work together. Actually, we worked with them to write the pro and the con. We worked together with no biases. We were looking for the facts. All we were trying to do was get the facts in the form. So just asking the voters to look at the facts and make the best decision they can with all the information that we've given them, and dig a little deeper so they can maybe break that tie.
Thank you both for your service. Mr. Shuford and Mr. Reitman, I assume you will be back in the regular session pursuing something more than a pilot, and this committee and the members of this committee at that time will probably be debating that issue, since it is an elections-related issue. So I do need to move on to the some 43 people that we need to interview over the next 2 hours. So I very much appreciate your service and appreciate you coming here today. If you want to make just a short 20-second closing remark. That's fine.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, really appreciate the opportunity. We will be back to discuss future legislation and how to make this an ongoing part of the process. We'll be following up with members with a video that gives a little bit better of a feel for the process and also the final report from our two reviews. So that'll be available to members of the committee to review and look at more of the details of the process. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Now, members of the committee, we are going to start into our public hearing process for the executive appointments. Just so for the sake of the audience, we are going to go through these very efficiently. We're going to ask whatever questions need to be asked. When you come forward, just make a 1 or 2 minute statement about what your background is and why you want to serve in this capacity, and we will see if there are any questions. We will go through all of the interviews first before we actually take any action on any of the appointments. That's our normal process. And we do have one gentleman signed up to testify on one of the appointments, so we will go to that at the appropriate time. And we have a couple of people that have conflicts, so that we are going to try to expedite those at this time. And so I'm going to go to the third item on my agenda, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Bridget Burns to the Commission on Children and Families. Ms. Burns, would you please just state your name for the record and say why you want to serve on the Commission on Children and Families.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Bridget Burns for the record, and I'm interested in being appointed to the Commission for Children and Families. I previously served on the State Board of Higher Education, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and also the Commission on the Legislature, and I work as the Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon University System. I'm interested in serving on this commission for the same reason that I do most of my public service and work. I'm passionate about eradicating poverty and helping underrepresented communities and families in need, and I think that there are some interesting challenges posed for that commission.
Any questions, Ms. Burns?
Yes.
What position did you fill at higher ed?
When I was on the board? Or
when you were on the board?
I was a student member twice for the State Board of Higher Education.
Thank you.
Seeing none. Thank you very much for coming here today. We're going to go to Christopher Brown, Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. Mr. Superintendent, if you'd please come forward, state your name for the record. Most of us hope that this is the only capacity we see you in.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Brown, and I'm the interim superintendent of your state police.
Any questions for Mr. Brown? Mr. Brown, could you talk to us a little bit about your long record in law enforcement?
Yes, sir. I must confess that the reason for my being here is not the result of any intent or design. Simply the fact that Superintendent McLean, who I think we all decided to wrap up a stellar career. In your material, you'll see that I've been blessed for the past 3 decades. Those opportunities have included a wide breadth of operational and support roles and a continuous ascension and responsibility, including Chief of Police and County Sheriff. I don't think anyone in law enforcement signs up to be the boss. But along the path, you are sometimes presented with chances that lead to opportunities to have more of an influence, really, on the success and the reputation of an agency and the environment that your co-workers work within. And while I miss doing the things that I signed up to be a police officer to do, I found that over the years that I've made a difference to the agencies that I've led, and I hope, at least in some small ways, I've made a difference since I've been at OSP. It's an important job and has a tangible impact on the people who are doing the job that I signed up for years ago. I love this agency, and I am profoundly proud of the people and the job we do, and I believe I have the depth and experience to do a good job for you. I know I have the character to do a good job for you. And if I have one salient strength, it's that I bring an enormous network of relationships and a myriad of circles throughout the state and throughout the nation. like my predecessor, I'm a relationship guy. And I think in this environment, those relationships and that cooperation are going to be the keystones for survival. We all have daunting challenges right now, the citizens, you folks, my colleagues, and our employees. But I think this is the environment where the rubber meets the road in terms of leadership. And this is the kind of time when someone has to make the agonizing decisions and take responsibility for them. It's the time that someone needs to keep the people focused and inspired. And someone has to keep the ship on course despite a very nasty storm. If given the chance, I will do the very best job I can for all of you and everyone involved. So,
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Procedural question. Will this change Officer Brown's title to superintendent and not interim superintendent?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, and thank you, Superintendent Brown. If you would stay, please have a seat. I believe we have one person to testify, so I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond if you chose to do so.
Certainly. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Atlansky, I hope I'm pronouncing that correct. If you would please come forward and state your name for the record, and we're going to ask everyone to limit their testimony to no more than 3 minutes.
Chair Devlin and Senate members, you're all aware of my program that I worked on for up to 5 years, which became part of Senate Bill 111, which titled Police Use of Deadly Physical Force. Our program is the only one in the nation that defines at the actual point of civil rights violations of when witnessing officers must react to stop said violations. I could name all five of our program outlines, but you haven't given me the time to do so. I will give people in the audience the documents so they could check it out at home. I have no problem with Chris Brown's background. I'll add one more thing to his background to prove that he was an instructor in ethics in training officers. What my problem is with Chris Brown is we sent him a letter 4 weeks ago of whether he supports or does not support our program, which is Oregon law. It is the second section of the law. If you pull up on the computer, Google any county within the state, you will find the words that police must receive new education and training. That is the only section, the only part, that one sentence that deals with preventive policing. Is it not the most controversial subject in this state? Every week, at least, it's a headline or back page issue. Today's paper, a letter to the editor. So my point right now is to ask one question for you folks up front to the Chris Brown. Does he not agree with the almost unanimous voting for that bill, Senate Bill 111, in favor, which is our program? The very next section is about the aftermath. If you follow our program, it eliminates the aftermath, 80% of the work, time, and funds that are being drained from the different throughout the state. Their funds for the law enforcement bureaus. I would like each and every one of you to ask a question of me, of my organization, as we have much more information to give out, and these few minutes does not give us the time to do that.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Adlansky? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming here today. Superintendent Brown, did you care to respond? Okay. Well, Mr. Adlansky, we're going to go on. Some of the issues that you've been brought forward have been debated in great detail in the legislature, and obviously I'll take a look at the statute. The reality is that Mr. Brown, having served never in a capacity at the level the superintendent is, but I believe he takes an oath of office similar to ours, which is that he basically upholds the Constitution of the United States and the constitutions of the state of Oregon, the laws thereof. So I think that this issue over the use of deadly force has been an issue of discussion of great detail in this body and will continue to be. Probably the most appropriate committee, which has been mostly discussed in, is our judiciary committees, both in the House and the Senate. So we will leave it at that. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll close that public hearing, and now we're going to a public hearing on the appointment of Antone Minthorn to the Columbia River Gorge Commission. Mr. Minthorn, you're there? If he is, he's...
Antone Minthorn here.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Minthorn, if you could just talk to us for a minute or two about your interest in service on the Columbia River Gorge Commission. I can assure you that I believe every member of this Rules Committee knows your background and has actually, in some cases, served with you. I'm very pleased by the governor putting you forward for this appointment.
Okay. You want me to talk a little bit about my interest?
Yes, just for about a minute.
Okay. In the past few recent years, as the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Confederated Tribes, I also served on the YM board, the Salado YM board, prior to the redevelopment of Salado Village. But as the tribal council decided that the Umatilla tribe should help redevelop Salado Village because we thought a presence of the village, the tribal village, in the Columbia River Gorge was important enough to pursue. So the Confederated tribes took a leading role in that they assigned their planning department to it to help begin finding the village to do the technical work and also to begin coordinating with the Army Corps of Engineers to initiate that. So I've always thought that Gorge was important to Native tribes, and also I've been aware of the Columbia River Gorge Scenic Act, and thought that was a good legislation that the board, that the gorge needed some protection. I'm very much willing to help in that endeavor. Some background from my experience, I have been in tribal, been a councilman for around 25 years, and I have watched economic development occur on Umatilla, the growth of the tribal economy, and the benefits, how it benefits the total community, the general community. My point is that I understand that the people.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Minthorn. Any questions from the committee? Well, thank you very much. We're going to move on to our next hearing, and we will come back to take action on your appointment at the end of the hearing today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Mike Holston
and Melissa Ryan to the Land Use Board of Appeals. If you would please both come forward. Please identify yourself for the record, proceed in whichever order you want to, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Michael Holston. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here today. I'll keep my opening comments fairly brief, and I've got an upper respiratory thing going on, so if my voice cracks, that's the reason. I'm currently a referee on the Land Use Board of Appeals, and before moving to Oregon in 1977, to attend law school, I worked in the Baltimore and Washington area as a planner. After law school, I worked with the McEwen Gisbell firm in Portland, with Metro, and ultimately with the Department of Justice. Then I've served for a number of years on the Land Use Board of Appeals. Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA, was created in 1979, a few years after the statewide land use planning program began. And I believe it serves five important functions. I'll mention a couple of those. The first one, obviously, is to resolve land use disputes quickly. And that's one of the main reasons LUBA was created in the first place. We resolve appeals within about 77 days after the record is settled. But there are a number of other important functions it serves, too, I believe. It does perform a little bit less formal forum where people can appear without a lawyer if they wish, although that's becoming increasingly dangerous for you to do because it's getting pretty complicated. Of course, then we have to just resolve ambiguous legislation in resolving the appeal, so we have to do that to decide the case, but it also gives the enacting body an opportunity to either embrace the way we resolve the ambiguity or reverse it if they disagree with us. And I think probably another important function is the facilitating appellate court review. We basically stand between the local land use decisions, of which they say there are about 10,000 each year, and the Oregon Court of Appeals. And we have the last word on an awful lot of those appeals, and the ones that go forward with a lot of the issues significantly narrowed to make the review by the court much simpler. I think I will leave it at that and be free to answer any questions.
Okay. Ms. Ryan, and then we'll go to questions.
Well, thank you. Board Member Holston did an excellent job of summarizing LUBA. My name is Melissa Ryan, and I'm currently a member of the Land Use Board of Appeals, LUBA. Prior to being appointed to LUBA in 2006, I was in private practice in Portland with two different firms, Dunn Carney and Miller Nash. And I've been honored to serve on LUBA in the last 4 years and help to efficiently resolve land use disputes statewide.
Okay. Any questions? Any questions? Okay. Thank you both for coming here today. Close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Blake Alexander, Kenneth Hill, Greg Mover to the Board of Boiler Rules. Please start in whichever order you've agreed on.
Senator Devlin, chairs. Blake Alexander, work for Chart Mechanical, looking to fill the spot of installer for the boiler board. A little history on myself. Been a member of Local 290 for 17 years. Been an instructor for 10 years at Local 290 in the evenings, instructing steam fitters and plumbers in the welding industry. A little more educational background is I am a member of the AWS. I hold a CWI Certified Welding Inspector's card.
Chair Devlin, Senators, thanks for the consideration of appointment to the Board of Boiler Rules. My name is Kenneth Hill from Cottage Grove. I've been in Oregon 22 years. I came here initially to do a large rebuild job in Wana, Oregon, fell in love with Oregon and settled down and went to work with Willamette Industries, Albany, Oregon. I'm applying for the owner-operator seat on the Board of Boiler Rules. I stayed with Willamette Industries, was acquired by Weyerhaeuser and subsequently International Paper, was approached by the Northwest Pulp and Paper Industry or Association to represent the owner-operators. Pulp and Paper operates very large industrial boilers in the state of Oregon, and there's a lot of current issues around carbon emissions and maximum achievable technology, things like that, that I have a strong interest in, and how boilers are basically addressed going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Greg Moyer. I will bring the State Board of Boiler Rules my 25 years of professional boiler operations and maintenance experience. I am confident that my long professional career specific to boiler operations will serve me in fulfilling my responsibilities as a board member. I would be honored to dedicate my time and effort to this public service role. I will serve with the integrity that I know will be required for this position. Thank you, Chair Devlin, and other members of the committee for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Any questions for Mr. Alexander, Mr. Hill, or Mr. Mover?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Alexander concerns me. I took a welding class last week, a mid-welding class, and I think Mr. Alexander would probably flunk me.
And probably for good reason.
Well, Senator Atkinson, welding is not without its dangers. So.
Incredible skill to have, though.
Any additional questions or comments? Well, thank three of you for coming here today, and we'll take action on your appointments a little bit later to make our recommendations to the full Senate. I will close that public hearing and open an appointment on the appointment of Roger Nyquist to the Construction Contractors Board.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, for the record, Roger Nyquist, 2896 Furwood Place in Albany, Oregon. I am a Linn County Commissioner and a bowling center as well. As a business owner in Oregon for the last 20 years, I have tremendous respect for the role that agencies play, and I'm honored to be before you this afternoon. Would answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Mr. Nyquist? Seeing none, thank you for coming here
today.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Samuel Henry to the Oregon State Board of Education. Mr. Henry. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Samuel D. Henry. I reside in Troutdale, Oregon, 97060, in the 3rd Congressional District. I am currently employed as a university professor in the Graduate School of Education at Portland State University, where I've worked since 1992. I am before you because I have an interest in serving on the State Board of Education. My interest in policy work in education has bloomed since the mid-1960s, and as you see from my resume and materials before you, I have more than 35 years of experience holding leadership positions in education and in the community. This record is underscored by a strong belief in K through 20 public schools, public service, and participatory democracy, including my 6 years as chair of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Of note also is that I'm a father of a 19-year-old college sophomore, Antonia, who in addition to costing me about $50,000 a year, plus or minus a few bucks, keeps me grounded. And through parental education, I hope that I reflect and refract the value of public good inherited from my parents, grandparents, and multiple community members who've invested in developing my leadership. This aspiration of a dream, working with others to further the kind of public education that fulfills our collective needs and hopes, continues to be one of the significant forces in our society and, in fact, in the world. Hence, I draw your attention to my professional and personal record of playing purposefully in the sandbox with others, hoping it meets with your approval. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am open to your questions.
Any questions from Senator Metzger?
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Henry, for really being willing to serve. What do you view as a member of the State Board of Education is one or two of the most significant issues, challenges, things that need to be fixed in public education in Oregon that as a board member you would bring to that organization?
Senator Metzger, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I believe the most pressing problem is one that I'm not necessarily going to bring, and that has to do with resources. I think there are other problems that we are certainly organized to address. There are a variety of them. There are several working committees on the board, but one of the key pieces that I think has to be a constant reminder is that we're a policy-making board, and that policy, the job of policymakers, is to work in consultation and communication with our publics and with you as the state legislature, and to really bring balanced approaches that help further public education.
And that question?
Yeah.
A follow-up to that, Mr. Henry, is, you know, we are, the country is facing a very difficult economic situation. It's, you know, part of the headlines every day, and it impacts all of our lives in various ways. And this assembly is impacted by, they have a $3 billion deficit and growing. All, you know, it's all tied together. You know, one out of every five Oregonians are on food stamps. People are losing their homes. We have one of the highest mortgage default rates now in the country on a percentage basis. And that's only compared to other bad places. And one of the biggest calls for, you know, building a better future is to having a more financially literate citizenry. And yet financial literacy is not something that is required of the students in the state of Oregon. And so they get out into the financial world, and at least systemically, there's nothing that would keep them from, as the next generation, to replicate all the bad financial issues that we have today. So the federal government is making regulation, state governments make regulation, but the best inoculation is a financially literate citizenry. How important to you is financial literacy? Do you think that is a gap in our K through a 12 school system? And what would you be willing to do to try and elevate that issue?
Senator Metzger, Chair Devlin, I do believe that that is something of critical interest to be worked on in both the K through 12 schools, community colleges, and in the university system. I think financial literacy is critical and important. I'm not sure I use competing interests in terms of financial literacy. I believe that if we educate people to think critically, that the financial piece is just one part of that, and that includes the ability to examine consumer messages and a variety of other spheres that our public is exposed to. But I certainly underscore and agree with you that that is something that's very important. I'm the new guy, if I get your approval, joining, sir, and I have to work with the other colleagues that are there. I'm certainly going to raise some issues, and my record indicates that I've raised issues from time to time that are neither popular nor the ones that necessarily people would wave a flag for in terms of wanting them to be the sole issue that they're working on. But I'm going to work with my colleagues, and under the direction and the laws that you have set out for the State Board of Education, try to be part of the best policy board that you got.
And one final comment,
yes.
Mr. Chair. One final thought is I would ask you to see, because I'm anxious to see as well, that a documentary is out called Waiting for Superman, and I don't know if you've heard about that. There was a nice piece in today's Wall Street Journal about that. The producer is the one who produced An Inconvenient Truth, also produced Barack Obama's presentation before the 2008 convention. But now a lot of traditional, long-standing educators are not very happy about it, but as the Wall Street pointed out, it is their inconvenient truth. And that is, you know, of how we're failing our kids. You mentioned resources. That's always an issue, but as this points out, that the resources themselves have not solved the problem. As kids, particularly minorities, do not have access, do not graduate to the next level to be able to compete. And what you would do as a member of the Board of Education, which is so important, is that leadership and that vision to be able to push against the tidal wave that heretofore has never been able to be pushed, and actually recognize what is the truth about education and how can we position ourselves not only with resources, because that is an important part of it, but what is it we've been doing for so long that is not allowing us and our kids of the future to compete with the kids from India and China and everyone else, you know, where the knowledge drain, you know, may go. And so I would just import upon you to, you know, see that and to recognize that while this body passes all kinds of legislation regarding education, the reality is the State Board of Education is in a position as the board of directors of this entire state's educational, and you can be a real leader on saying, let's figure out what isn't working and be able to recognize, even if they are inconvenient truths, what needs to change. So thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Dr. Henry, would you like to respond in any way?
Senator Farrelly, members of the committee, I underscore everything that you've said. I am looking forward to seeing that film, and I think that when we have something placed before us, we have to do some real introspection in terms of education, in terms of what we've accomplished. And I certainly agree with most of the statements you've made. We have not done all that we need to do with the resources we have, and we haven't had the resources we need to do all that we can do. And that's a particular problem in Oregon with our rate of failure to complete high school, for example, which I think, quite frankly, is disgraceful. And I'm certainly going to work as a member of the board to do everything possible. And Senator, if you are going to be watching the film soon, I'd be glad to watch the film with you.
Okay, we might just do that. Well, thank you, and thank you for your willingness to serve, too.
Thank you.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Professor Henry, you actually answered my first question to you, which had to do with the egregious dropout rate,
yeah.
Which I think is a tragedy. Since I've been here, education spending has gone up $1 billion, and we still have a high dropout rate, and that's only been 12 years. A couple of questions. First question is that we have 91 elected people in the legislature, including one governor. Everyone who campaigns says that education is the priority. Everybody does. You get a picture, you and the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a partisan thing, but 91 Oregonians do it. And everyone says it's the priority, but yet it's the very last budget to pass here.
Yeah.
Every session. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Farrelly and members of the committee, Senator Atkinson, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and since Dwight Eisenhower, every president has said he's going to be the education president of the United States. Almost everybody in each of the states that I've lived in, and I've lived in five different states, has said when they're running for public office, they are going to put education first. I'm going to be 63 next month. I've grown a little skeptical in some of those responses, but I've also seen an awful lot of people with goodwill toward education looking for some solutions. And I hope that one of the roles that the board can play is to be a catalytic agent for that and for the better solutions rather than the pontificating and postulating. It's a reality in our soundbite age that education seems to be something that we all want to talk about. But until we are really ready to say that we are standing behind something that's going to make sense, I think we need to look for some other solutions.
Professor, I've had that bill introduced for the last 10 years to force the body to pass the education, the biggest budget, the mortgage payment, within 81 days. And the Department of Education, the lobby behind education, and the State Board of Education has been crickets. Almost makes me think they like it to be funded last. Just a thought. Next is an assignment I'd like you to do. You're going to get affirmed. There's a tremendous amount of interest in your excitement and in your style and being on this board. But here's a math problem that I'd love to have some help and help understanding. And let me just do very raw, easy to understand numbers. Say, take the politics. Just assume that I've got the numbers slightly close. Let's say there's $10,000 per student in a class, a huge class of 30. That's $300,000 in that classroom. And let's back out the cost of the teacher plus PERS and all that, about 80 grand. Could the State Board of Education help tell me where the other 220 goes?
Members of the committee, Senator Atkinson, as you know, I'm pending your approval.
You're going to get our approval.
And I quite frankly don't know.
I know.
But
that's the point.
I quite frankly will return to you and say this is what I believe this is and where it comes from.
Professor Henry, the reason I ask you two very difficult questions is your reputation is incredible. Your excitement and passion that you bring to it is very well received. My good colleague to the left of me, both politically and physically, whispered to me, I love this guy. There is the feeling of, we love this guy coming to your nomination. That's why I'm asking you the hard questions, because I know a lot of times what happens in this committee is people get the thing and say, and then all of a sudden, Senator who? And they forget the hard questions that I ask. But I have a belief that you'll get back to me, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Dr. Henry, I don't know that he is expecting a response to that, but I do have a comment I'd like to share with you as well. I think there is a great deal of confidence that you're going to do the very best job you can do. You bring an awful lot of skill and ability to the task at hand. But currently, about only 70% of Oregon schools are meeting minimum federal standards for reading and math. And when I went to school, high school, in the last century, well back into the last century, 69.999% was a B. That was a failing grade. And if I had brought that grade home, I would be due a terrible beating at home. And my question is, who in Oregon is really in control of the enterprise of education? Because as our colleagues have already pointed out, I think all of us have voted for the highest number offered to fund education from the legislative level. And like my good colleague, I never met anybody who ran on a platform of dismantling education. It just doesn't happen. You don't hear it. So the legislature is making a mighty contribution in terms of the allocations and the appropriations. But the product isn't getting delivered at the other end. So I guess in context of my 70% and the horrible beating that's due, who should be getting that horrible beating? Who is controlling the enterprise of education and producing such an abysmal output?
Chair Devlin, Senator Ferrioli, I think we're all due for a beating. When we don't have the kind of expectations that our kids coming out of school don't realize that a high school education is not going to be enough, we're the ones responsible for that message, and we're all due that beating. I agree with you, and I think my parents went to the same school of parenting, bringing home 69 or 70 just wasn't it. We have to hold up a mirror of accountability, and I know as members of the legislature that you do that, but we have to dig a little deeper in terms of our own culpability and figuring out some ways to work together to do something better and something different. It is, as you have phrased it, it is utterly irresponsible and it is utterly reprehensible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions for Mr. Henry? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to serve, and we'll take action on your appointment a little bit later in this meeting. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Melanie Adams and Bruce Freeman to the Electrical and Elevator Board. Please proceed.
Sure, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Melanie Adams. I'm the building official for the City of Albany, and I am also the Secretary, Treasurer, and Legislative Committee Chair for the Oregon Building Officials Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about appointment to the Electrical and Elevator Board. I'm interested in serving on this board because I believe strongly in the importance of a vibrant statewide building safety program and the consistent application of the State Building Code. As building official for the City of Albany, I'm committed to both protecting public safety and supporting a positive business environment. And if confirmed, I will bring the same focus to the Electrical and Elevator Board. I am a former teacher and a former trial attorney, and I believe I would bring a unique perspective to the board. Thank you for the opportunity to be of service.
Mr. Freeman.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Freeman. I reside in Clatskanie, Oregon, and I've worked at the Wanda Paper Mill for the last 23 years as an electrical engineer. During that time, I have been honored to work with the electricians, the apprentices, and the contractors in making sure that their licensing is okay and their CEO credits are correct. I welcome this opportunity and would like to bring my experience to that board. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Adams or Mr. Freeman? Thank you both for coming here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Mary McKay and Dennis Ross to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Mary McKay, and I live in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm the Deputy Superintendent of Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Service District, and I'm in charge of human resources. In my role, I've worked with employees on dismissal, disciplinary action, and programs of assistance who are members of the Lynn Benton Lincoln Education Association and their representatives. I seek this appointment because I feel I have experience that can contribute to the work of the board, and because I believe that I can learn from it too by participating. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and well, I'm glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Ross.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Ross. I'm mayor of Maupin. For the record, I live at 599 Fifth Street with a mailing address of P.O. Box 189 in Maupin, 97037. I've been mayor for 7.5 years, and prior to that I served 4 years on the South Wasco County School District Board of Directors, two of them as president. My reason for wanting to serve is to bring to the Fair Dismissals Appeal Board experience with issues concerning the smallest of our schools in the state. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today here at the Capitol, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
Just yes. A statement?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes, Senator Farrell.
Mayor, the mayor has a distinction that I notice on his statement of interest form that can be claimed by very few others, and that is that his state legislators and his U.S. congressmen are all Republicans. And it is very rare that I see any applicant for any board or commission in this role who's not represented by a Democrat in Congress, a Democrat in the state legislature, or a Democrat in the Senate. But I see, in fact, that you are one of a very select minority. I'd like to change that, of course, but that is a distinction that you have. I think no other appointee to this board or commission, any of them that we're seeing today, can claim. So congratulations, sir.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farrelly, part of that comes from also having 197 combat missions.
There you go.
Well, Senator Farrelly, I think the mayor and I have had a few discussions before, so.
And I can almost anticipate the results of those discussions.
No, they were friendly, civil discussions.
Thank you for your service, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you both for coming. Thank you both for being willing to serve. I'm going to close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Daniel Dunham to the Long-Term Care Advisory Commission. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Dan Dunham. I live in Corvallis in Benton County. I've been nominated to serve on the State Advisory Council on Long-Term Care. For your information, and as part of my background, I am currently in my sixth year serving as a local long-term care ombudsman, and in that time, I have come to understand the long-term care system as an essential element of our communities, and that it is critically important that our senior citizens have access to quality long-term care when they or their families are no longer able to provide the care they require. There are at least four key reasons why I am interested in this, serving on this advisory committee, and I will mention them somewhat in my priority order. First of all, the adequacy of the training of the staff at the long-term care facilities and through our community college system. I think we do not have anywhere near the involvement of community colleges that we need in the training of medical aides, nurse aides, licensed practical nurses, and others, the support staff at these facilities. The quality of care related to costs, especially in private pay facilities. Most people can't afford this long-term care at private pay, and yet many of our facilities are private pay and do suffer in some cases from a low level of quality of the care provided. The recruitment, training, and continuing education and retention of folks like me, local long-term care ombudsman. Our state is serving several hundred long-term care facilities with five deputies from the state office. That is a ratio of about 50 per. I serve nine. That's a big load. Most of us serve about four. At the top of my list, and the one that I've become very familiar with just recently, is my concern for the extended care for memory care residents whose needs go beyond the capability of local memory care facilities. I just don't know where we're going to go with them. It's a big problem for us. Throughout my career as an educator and administrator at the local, state, and federal levels, I have worked under the guidance of advisory boards and committees, and I have served on advisory and administrative boards, and I believe I understand the roles and functions of these bodies and how I'm expected to behave as a member of an advisory committee, and that is as an advisor, not as an administrator. And I am certainly prepared to serve on the Oregon Long-Term Care Advisory Committee. I welcome your support for my confirmation, and I'm ready for any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Dunham? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Thank you. We very rarely get as highly qualified a volunteer, but I would think that if folks listening to this confirmation hearing hear a familiar ring to the voice that they've heard, it's because the applicant is the public address announcer for Oregon State University sports, the marching band, the Corvallis American Legion baseball team, Corvallis high school football, and coordinates all the national anthem performers for all OSU sports. So his is a very familiar voice to people.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you. Well, Senator Farioli, I think I'm going to get in trouble for this statement. If Senator Courtney was on this committee, we would probably be continuing for the next 20 minutes with this.
Thank you very much.
Always happy to stand in for Senator Courtney.
Okay, I'll close that public hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on the appointment of Karen Thompson and Jay Winchester to the Mechanical Board. Ms. Thompson is on the line. Okay. Ms. Thompson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Ms. Thompson, if you could simply state your interest in serving on the mechanical board and a little bit of your background in just 1 or 2 minutes, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Okay, Chair Devlin and members of the committee, I'm an attorney. I have been an attorney for 20 years, working primarily in personal injury and also representing people who have been injured at construction sites and doing construction-related work. I became very interested in serving on a committee that has some input. I want to see how the system works and maybe follow up with it. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Thompson? Seeing none, well, thank you very much for calling in today, and thank you for your willingness to serve. The committee will make a recommendation to the full Senate at the conclusion of our hearings today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Winchester.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Jay Winchester, and I reside at 728 North Yamhill Street in Carlton, Oregon. I have been employed by Washington County for 23 years, started out as a mechanical structural inspector. Approximately 15 years ago, I was promoted into supervisor capacity, and at that time, I became involved with the code development process for the mechanical code, both nationally and on the state level. Past member of the Oregon Mechanical Officials Association, past president in 2007, and most recently worked as the chairman for the code development review for the current mechanical code that we now have in place.
Any questions?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Jay, would you hold still? You've got a fan in the back, and I'm trying to take your picture for her. There you go.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. I had to teach him how to use the Zoom.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. I will close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Dr. William Purnell to the Board of Medical Imaging. Dr. Purnell. Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is William Purnell. I'm a diagnostic radiologist living here in Salem. I work at Mission Medical Imaging and the Doctors Clinic in Salem and at Sandia Memorial Hospital in Staten. I'm an applicant for appointment to the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging and have applied in order to serve the citizens of Oregon. I support the board's mission to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare of Oregonians while undergoing medical imaging studies. As a member of the American College of Radiology, I support the ACR practice guidelines, technical standards, and appropriateness criteria. I believe that my training and practice experience in diagnostic imaging can be of value to the board. With your consent, I look forward to working with my colleagues on the board in fulfillment of its mission. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today.
Any questions for the doctor? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Close that public hearing. Opening a public hearing on the appointment of Dr. Jessica Lynch to the Oregon Board of Optometry.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Lynch, and I live in Forest Grove, Oregon. I'm an optometrist in private practice in Hillsborough, as well as a clinical instructor at Pacific University College of Optometry. I've been in practice for 8 years, both in private and retail practice. I'm being appointed to the Oregon Board of Optometry, and I've been in practice now for 8 years. I'm interested in getting involved in the kind of different aspects of the practice of optometry. We're a legislative committee or profession, and I'm interested in helping with that, learning more how that works and serving that. And I look forward to working with the fellow board members and serving the community in the optometrist. Do you have any? I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Ms. Lynch? Well, you can see that there's business for you at this dais. So. Thank you very much for coming here today, and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you for that opportunity.
I will close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Shannon Pullen to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board.
Thank you, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. It's an absolute honor to be nominated to this advisory board. Excuse me, I have a head cold, so my voice might be giving out. And I just recently moved to Senator Burdick's district, so it's a privilege to meet you as well today. I feel like I am a good fit for this advisory board. First and foremost, I'm a family member of my brother is at the Oregon State Hospital under the PSRB. I'm his advocate, so I regularly attend his treatment team meetings, and so I have a really good sort of view of what goes on at the hospital and the issues that affect patients. I have a second brother who has been at the state hospital for evaluation, and so mental illness is a big part of my family's life. Second of all, I'm a family-to-family, I'm a NAMI member, and that's who I'm representing here today, and I'm a family-to-family teacher, and I'm also a statewide family-to-family trainer, so I actually teach people how to teach that class. So it is doing that volunteer work that I have a chance to talk with Oregonians from all over the state about their dealings with mental illness and with the state hospital. Although I'm a stay-at-home mom, I do a lot of volunteer work, and so in my former life, my professional life, I've worked for Mercy Corps and the Oregon Food Bank, and in all of my positions, I've been able to start new programs, to identify needs, and to raise funds and get something done. In my volunteer work, I've sat on several boards, helping them to identify the direction that they want to go in for some new emerging nonprofits. So I feel like my professional background is there. But really, the fourth quality that I'd like to talk about today is just the quality of my heart, and that's the piece that you don't get on an application. And I think that's the piece that I really bring to this position, which is that I am a person who is filled with joy, and despite the fact that I have to deal with a lot of very serious and tragic issues, I didn't dream that I would grow up to be a mental health advocate, but I feel like I have a good open presence, somebody who likes to engage, to get things done, and so that's the quality that I bring to this position, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Pullen. Questions for Ms. Pullen?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm glad you're in my district.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for coming here today, and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
I'll close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointments of Jim Rissey and James Wathen to the Board of Directors of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission.
Sure, if we have another,
he's going to be on the
phone with that. There it is. Hi, Mr. Wathen. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you just take only about 1 or 2 minutes and state a little bit about your background and your interest in serving on the Patient Safety Commission?
I'd be happy to. Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Jim Wathen. I live at 55062 Ruby Loop in Mandan, Oregon. I'm currently the Chief Executive Officer for Southern Coos Hospital and Health Center. I've been in hospitals, particularly this hospital, in the state of Oregon for the past 15 years. Overall, I've spent 23 years in Oregon hospitals. Since I started working in healthcare back in 1978. Hospitals are so important to me, to the people that we serve, and I think that the work of the Patient Safety Commission is critical to providing people with the tools and the approaches that are necessary to assure quality and patient safety among hospitals, particularly in the state of Oregon. My hospital in Bandon has been recognized by the small and rural hospitals within our state as the quality leader. We're the number one critical access hospital in Oregon with respect to patient satisfaction. We're the number three possibly all of the state of Oregon patient satisfaction. That is due to our dedication to quality and patient safety and using those as guides in our provision of patient care and fulfillment of our individual roles and responsibilities. I would like to carry that forward to the committee as a resource and a tool for them, and I look forward to being able to serve because it will benefit not just other hospitals, but also ours.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Watson? Seeing none, thank you very much for your interest in serving. We'll take action on your appointment a little bit later in this meeting.
Thank you for your consideration. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Ms. Ricci.
Yes, thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jill Ricci, 1300 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. I'm an assistant professor of public administration at Portland State University, and in that capacity, I conduct research looking at the development of public policy, particularly in the context of health, population health, and healthcare delivery. And I also teach in the Master in Public Health and Master in Public Administration programs, specifically Health Management, Administration, and Policy. I understand that you already have some information about my educational and professional background, so let me speak to you about my interest in serving on the Patient Safety Commission. The first is really simply a belief in the value of public service. As somebody who teaches and is engaged in public administration and has had a career as a clinician, as a public sector research and management analyst, health services administrator, now in academia, my career has really been shaped by the desire to do some work that is challenging and personally and also contributes to some degree to the greater good. I believe that good public policy can positively affect population health. In fact, the research and teaching that I do hopefully speaks to that. And so I believe that this background, this combination and range of experience would be directly relevant to the work of the commission. Most importantly, serving on the commission, I believe, will provide a very meaningful opportunity to be engaged with a very critical issue in healthcare and contribute in some way to that. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Ricci? Seeing none, thank you very much for your interest in serving, and we'll take action a little bit later in this meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close that public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Christine Schutt to the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. I hope I pronounced that correctly. But
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Christine Schutt.
Okay.
And I am hoping to be appointed to the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I'm interested in the appointment to the Board of Pharmacy because I'm after a long career with the state of Oregon, I'm getting ready to retire, and I'm not really ready to give up the hard thinking and careful listening that goes along with practicing in the public area. I really want to have an opportunity to continue public service in a way that uses my analytical skills and takes advantage of my status as an ignorant outsider to listen to what the experts are, the pharmacists, the people who do the work every day. I think I can help them by not knowing what they're talking about in some respects. What do I think I bring? I think my ability to listen very carefully, my ability to analyze difficult concepts and difficult situations, and my ability not to have exactly the same vocabulary as everybody else on the Board of Pharmacy, I think will be a real asset. I should say also that I live out in on Gooseneck Creek Road out in rural Polk County, and I think there are some unique issues that relate to rural providing health care in a rural setting, and I'm looking forward to learning about what kinds of benefits we can bring to the rural population through uses of technology and moving into the new age. That's all. Thanks.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I will close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Jennifer Wood to the Physical Therapist Licensing Board.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Wood. I'm a licensed physical therapist assistant. I've been nominated to the Physical Therapist Licensing Board. My address is in Westland, Oregon. I'm currently employed as a PTA in a skilled nursing facility. I first became interested in serving on the licensing board after volunteering for 2 years on the PT Licensing Board Rules Advisory Committee. This committee consists of practicing therapists and educators who would meet to discuss and debate issues and rules pertaining to the practice of PT in Oregon. We've then present our recommendations to the licensing board. I enjoyed the professional collaboration and problem solving that took place on this committee. The strengths I bring to the current PT licensing board are I have 21 years' experience in the clinical practice of PT, but I've worked in a variety of settings. My current work in long-term care and skilled nursing facilities would bring a diversity to the board. It's a nice complement. The current board has outpatient, hospital, and education therapists. I've always been a strong patient advocate and interested in doing what's best for my patients. And I'm passionate about my profession and have the time and energy to spend on this position. I would appreciate your support and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Wood? Thank you very much for coming today. Okay, I'll close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Pat West to the Public Employees Retirement System Board. Ms. West.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. I'll start by just putting my name, Pat West. Address is 4561 Shadow Hills Drive Southeast, Turner, Oregon, on the record, 97392. And I know most of the people in this room because I've, was a long-term legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters and then president for the Oregon State Firefighters, was a Salem firefighter for 27 years. Understand as well as anyone can the PERS system, a lot of the ins and outs of the system, and of course this position is for the member rep, and I am a retired member. As you know, you guys, you the legislature amended the law last session allowing a retiree to hold this position, and so I am here as a retiree, and the reason is that I feel that Oregon has done well for me. I was a firefighter, provided a decent benefit. I feel that it's time for me to give back, so I'm willing to give the time to do what I can to help the system maintain.
Questions for Mr. West? Thank you for coming here today. Thank you for your willingness to serve, and thank you for taking on such a challenging set of issues. So,
thank you.
I will close that hearing, and I'm going to open up a hearing on the appointments of David Batista and Sarah Boley to the Quality Education Commission.
Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Boley. I live at 35575 Southwest Orchid Hill Lane in Hillsboro, Oregon. And I have been nominated to represent other community members on the Quality Education Commission. That being said, I am a parent of two children who went through the Hillsboro schools and onto university systems in other states. And even though they did not major in economics, ended up very deeply involved in careers in the area of financial analysis. So I was interested in some of the past comments that were made by committee members. I have recently retired from the Beaverton School District, actually after 37 years of service, in which capacity I taught. I was a curriculum and instruction specialist. I was a high school vice principal. I opened a new high school as a principal. And during the past 6 years, I served as a deputy superintendent of teaching and learning. Particularly in my years as an administrator, I spent a great deal of time determining how to best allocate resources so that we could really move the needle on student achievement in the Beaverton schools, and in fact did assist with the facilitation of our most recent budget cuts and budget cuts as far back as 1999. So I'm intimately familiar with the ins and outs of how money is spent in a district, and the complexities of ensuring that go along with ensuring that the way in which money is spent is aligned with both best practices and the expectations of the state. So I'm very interested and very excited to see if there is anything I can do as a public citizen now to continue to support the implementation efforts of the Oregon Diploma, because that holds tremendous progress for the state, or potential for the state to actually make certain every one of our students is career and college ready. I'm impressed with the work of the Quality Ed Commission, and I believe that we are at a crossroads in our history right now. We absolutely must move from isolated, fragmented approaches to trying to implement school improvement to a consistent, coherent, focused, statewide strategy that will really get us there. I think we know how to do it. I know we do. I think that's the reason our district was awarded an I-3 grant recently. We are seeing tremendous progress over 6 years in the movement of student achievement, not just among high-risk kids, but among all kids. So we must be intent on raising the bar and raising the floor for all kids, and I think we know how to do it. I'd love to help in any way I can. I'm certain I'll find a way to do so regardless. But thank you very much for considering my nomination, and I think that David probably ought to go before me, and then if you have questions, actually, I'm sorry, Chair Devlin, you probably determine the order of business.
That's fine. I'm not a stickler. Well, thank you very much, and we will go to Mr. Bautista, and then we'll go to questions.
Chair Devlin, members of the board, my name is David Bautista, and I live at 2880 Dalton Street, South Salem. Currently, I'm the superintendent of Woodburn Public School, and I'm extremely interested in the questions that the committee asked. And we are working very diligently to provide a first-class education for our students at Woodburn School District. My interest is absolutely twofold. One, to continue and follow the pattern of quality education for Oregon students. And second one, to provide voice for the Latino community that's an increasing 20% of our students that needs a lot of support. If you have any questions, we will be gladly to support.
Okay. Any questions from Ms. Bolle or Mr. Bautista?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
A couple of questions.
Yes,
Mr.
Sure.
Atkinson. Thank you both for serving. Your credentials are just wonderful to have on the commission. An opinion question. And you mentioned it a little bit. I was going, and you heard my questions to Professor Henry earlier. But one thing that has bothered me for a long time is the amount of high school graduates in Oregon that don't stay in Oregon to go to school. And I give you lots of personal stories, but I won't. What's the solution to that? What's the solution to getting high school seniors to become college freshmen in Oregon universities?
You talk, I'm sorry, were you asking either one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, our students are, I think we have a lot of students from California coming up to the University of Oregon right now, I believe. But
particularly on the football side.
Right. I think part of the problem is not enough students go to college, period. We've always had a pretty consistent number going out of state. And it's difficult to deal with it would be difficult to change the minds of those students. But what we do have are just too few students going, period. If all of our students were prepared to go, but that's going to require a pre-K 20 strategy, strategic approach to making certain all students are college and career ready. We need to work more with our universities, and I know that we've started to do that. We can't really ensure that the standards, that the level of work that we are expecting of students is really where it needs to be for college readiness and success, unless we're working directly with university professors who have an opportunity to look at the work our students are producing and can tell us that this is the level of work that will ensure those students do well. When those partnerships are forged, and we're there now, and as they are strengthened, then the opportunity for students to study through early college and other means early. Some kids need to move more quickly. The system is holding them back. Some students are invited to leave the system. It's reprehensible, but they are. Far too early, far before they should be invited to leave. And if we could keep them in the system, they would be in the state. And I know our early college has been enormously successful. We have 500 students there now. I believe we could easily enroll a couple thousand right now in our district if we had, well, we will eventually do that. So we're working, our teachers are being paired up with actually tenure line teachers at Portland State to work on what the curriculum needs to look like. And I know an outgrowth of that will be more students attending and prepared to graduate. But I don't mean to dominate that.
One of the things is connections, caring. Once we have a connection between students, parents, and teachers and the school system, we have a way to support the families and the students to go on. The partnerships that we have with the Oregon University system, at least in Woodburn and in Chemehuevca, to get our students right away and support them into going to their academic pathway. The other is true, not many students are providing an idea that they will go to university. However, in our 12th grade right now, with 364 future graduates right now, we're looking into how we're going to be making sure that all of our students graduate.
One more question.
Yeah. And thank you. And along that line, Superintendent, if I could talk to you after this, there's a Latino student that I'm involved with that I've got a question that only you can answer, or I think you can help me find the answer, let me put it that way. If my history is correct on this commission, I think this commission came into effect in after a law that was passed in 1997.
Correct.
And it became a real political commission because everybody said, well, it's a political compromise. We'll create a commission. And the commission will come back to the legislature every year and say, all we need is more money. And so for, I think, the first 6 or 8 years of this commission, this is essentially, maybe it was a bad reputation, but politics is what they are. And that's what had happened. And so I think there's many of us who are very interested to see that this commission actually get to the mission, which I believe both of you are intimately qualified for, which is how do you build quality? Given that, the question that I asked Professor Henry, you don't have to have an answer for it now, but I would really love to have your input, and you can send it to me, and I'll make sure all my colleagues have it, especially both from two of you who come from administration. Rough numbers, again. What we always do when I lay this out, everybody says, well, you're off by $1,000, so they never give me the right answer. So let's just assume a huge classroom, an overstuffed classroom of 30 students at $10,000 each, back out the cost of the teacher. Help me understand where that other $200,000 goes. Now, I have been informed there's lots of studies, and everybody's going to give me this much information and give me the answer, but really, the answer's not there. And I know the answer's there, but this commission can go a long way to changing the reputation since 1997 if we're all on the same page. And I don't know why this bothers me so much. Maybe I'm too young to be this old at this, but I just don't believe there's a whole bunch of honesty. I'm not saying anyone's dishonest, but I don't believe there's a lot of honesty in how we fund education. I believe we write a really big check, and legislature's over, and Republicans are anti-kids and I mean, it's just, it's the same thing every year. And it's not honest. And I'm not pointing the finger directly. I mean, there's a lot of people who make a whole bunch of money off this broken system. But in the end, it doesn't get to the kids. So, for instance, I'll give you a perfect case in point. I got I remember one time there was a school district adjacent to yours that came up to me and was really upset because they couldn't, they needed more money if they had just passed a special appropriation so that they could line their swimming pool, which was legitimate. I mean, they had a swimming program. At the same time, I've got a public school in Rogue River, Oregon, that laid off all its janitorial staff, and the principal took his two-week vacation and painted the school himself. I mean, enormous disparity. But when we come here, it's Republicans are against kids. I don't know why. And Democrats are great for kids, and they'll write the big check. I don't know why. But at the end, nobody knows where the money goes. That's the help. You don't have to answer that now. If you could get back to me, I'd love it.
We know absolutely where the money is. We just, I mean, we've been cutting, but we know that. But in answer to your question quickly, and I know David and I can get back to you with exact figures, but most of the money is in people. What I think the public isn't aware of is over the years, more and more salaried money has gone to specialists who are serving kids with other needs. So the big issue we're grappling with is, what is a better strategy? Providing classroom teachers with the resources to address the needs of all kids, or continuing to use more and more specialists? And we think we know the answer. I think these are very exciting times. I know, and your question is an excellent one. And I believe the Superman that's being referenced is actually the super teacher. We're all waiting for the super teacher. So why can some teachers do it and others can't, is really the question. And then how are we aligning resources to ensure that whatever is happening with those teachers who can do it continues to be supported?
I think that's great. All I'm saying is, look, everybody realizes it's a huge labor-intensive job. Mm-hmm. And the teachers today are getting everything. They're having to be referee, parent. They got kids coming who are sleepy, kids that are coming unprepared. You got parents that aren't involved. Then you got parents like the Atkinsons are too involved. I mean, you get the whole gamut, right? I understand that. But what I'm trying to say is, help us to better understand when we write that check. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There is one thing that I might ask you in terms of this. One of the difficulties I find in the legislature with the quality education model is that, because this is the portion of the model that always gets publicized, and that is whatever you come up with is for an ultimate figure of how much funding would be necessary for us to meet all of our requirements on the date that we specified we wanted to get to these standards, etc. People mostly look at the big number. That's all that they look at, is the big number and how far you're away from the number. I think it would be better if people, it's not the only model that's out there, but it's the best one that we have, and it's a best practices model. If they looked more closely at the model itself, they would probably be able to see how they could improve the educational system they have. I mean, what are the highest priorities within that model? And if you wanted to look at it from the ground up, you could actually see what it would take to basically build a school district or a school from the ground up, so you'd get some more reality about what the actual costs were. Because it's not, I mean, everyone simply wants to look at the big figure and make the comparison between the big figure and whatever level of funding we end up at. But they don't look at the detail, and it's really not, I hate to say it this way, I mean, there's a lot of study in terms of the best practice, but the model itself is not rocket science. It doesn't take much to read through it and sort of realize what is a reasonable class size, what is not. How many counselors you would like to have if you would have the counseling programs that you'd like to have. You know, how many specialists you might need in some areas depending upon what the demographics and of your students are. And what are reasonable administrative expenses for a school district. All those things are there. I mean, I'm commenting more than questioning, but it's part of the problem with the commission is the only figure we actually see is the big figure, and somehow you need to get people to look deeper than that. So if you'd want to respond or wait, that'd be fine.
I think in these difficult times, we need to work smarter.
and look at the resources that we have and take advantage of that. Absolutely, right now in Woodburn, we're going to a study of our budget, $66.5 million, to what it's going to be. It really doesn't matter what it's going to be. We're going to be doing our job and the best we can for our kids. We're not going to let them down. So it's looking smarter. Is looking at human resources that are going to be there for the students who need different things.
Senator Perry, will you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I really appreciate the fact that you're two education professionals that could really make this commission a worthwhile endeavor, because today, and for about 13 years in this building, I've considered this the Brick at the Moon Committee. You know, you can stand on the porch out here and throw a brick at the moon, or just look at the budget that we're discussing in Ways and Means and add a billion or two. Whatever number that the committee comes up with is irrelevant, and we will write our letter to ourselves, which explains why we didn't fund to that level, which is because the money isn't there. You know, you end up in a discussion about whether or not you're going to provide minimal services in health and human services and minimal services in public safety as a product of doing the recommendation of the commission. So it's a great pointless exercise. The formulas are designed to be unattainable. If you look very hard at the laws that describe what this commission does relative to the dollar amounts. But if you look at the stuff the commission is supposed to do that don't directly lead to the dollar issues, the performance issues, the best practices issues, this commission could be the most important commission in Oregon. It really could. And what it needs to do is help us figure out why that there's no common denominator as a predictor of performance in schools. We've heard today, because I said it, that 70% of the schools meet the federal minimum standards for performance. But when you look at the schools, they're in rich districts, they're in poor districts, they're in urban districts, and they're in rural districts. And those, all of those schools are meeting the minimum standards. The ones that are not meeting the minimum standards are also in rich districts, poor districts, urban and rural districts. So, you know, you can't just point to the urban center of the city or the rural poor districts and say, gee, those schools are failing. You know, they're predictably because they don't have the resources. Some of those are the best schools that we have. So the common denominator is a mystery. The other one that I think is a mystery is you have two classrooms side by side in a school, and if you track the performance of the kids, one of those classrooms is producing failing students, and the one right next door to it is producing successful students. The question of why is the one that's the big mystery. And I'll tell you that I think there are districts in the U.S. that are figuring it out. Recently, I think this happened in New York City, they published the performance statistics for every student by teacher, so and by classroom. So you could look at a school and identify a teacher and know that that teacher was competent because the kids were succeeding. And similarly, you could identify a classroom and a teacher and know that there was something else going on there because the kids were failing, and this is within a school. So, you know, if they don't bother to throw another brick at the moon. We don't need that, because any of us could add a billion or two and come up with a number, and then we'll write a letter and tell you why we're not going to spend that much, because it isn't there. But what we don't know is what the common denominator for success is among those schools, however they're situated, that are successful, and among those classrooms, wherever they're situated, that produce students that succeed. Those are the things that would be the most important for this commission to do, and it's in your charge. You can do it. So I'd urge you to take that challenge forward. We can play with the math, and we won't change the system. We need to change the outcomes.
Senator Farioli, I appreciate greatly what you've said. I think we do know what the common denominator is. It's effective teachers. The question is, what behaviors, what characteristics typify those effective teachers? And the reason I'm excited about the Quality Ed Report, the most recent one, is that some of the variables they're identifying are such as teachers working together in continuous improvement cycles and collaborating around shared standards identified by the state and, you know, endorsed by our university system. Reason I'm excited about that is I think we're close to maybe being able to implement that. That being said, it's not all about money, because you know right now what we do is give oftentimes the same amount of money to individual classrooms and we get very different results.
Right.
And we know that there is more variability in student achievement from teacher to teacher in the same school than there is from school to school. So when I referenced earlier that we are at a crossroads, what we need is to do something about the isolation and fragmented approaches to improving student achievement. What I'm trying to say is we need to take what we know now, and I know that Woodburn has done wonderful work, and I know many of our teachers have done wonderful work, and we know what they're doing, and make certain that we can turn that into a shared vision for the state and a strategy, a high-leverage strategy that will get us there, not just this, this, and this, and we spend this much amount on this or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, I
yes.
think the discussion leads me to believe that we're closing in on the question. And the question for me is, if we can identify the characteristics of successful teachers and identify those teachers, we must also be able to identify the characteristics of unsuccessful teachers and identify those teachers. Then the question that we're narrowing in on is, now what? Now that you know, what do you do about it? You know, that's...
I have an answer for that.
I'd like to hear it, but I'm afraid that would overshadow your appearance here at some point.
Well, thank you both very much. Thank you for your willingness to serve, and we'll take action on your appointments in just a few minutes. I will close that public hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on the appointment of Kevin Parks to the Respiratory Therapist Licensing Board. Well, Mr. Parks is coming forward. I want to apologize to the members of the audience who are waiting here for interviews or for other reasons. This is taking a little bit longer than we had anticipated, but fortunately we should be done within about 20 or so minutes. I also wanted to apologize to the members of the audience and to the committee that I don't know why, but our telephone system that is normally terrible is even far worse today. So I think, and it's nothing to do with the staff. The staff's been trying to do everything they can with it, but I think most of us that have cell phones would have much clearer communications with the people that are on the phone than we're having here today. So, Mr. Parks.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. My name is Kevin Parks, members of the committee. I'm an attorney in Portland. I actually live in Senator Atkinson's district for about a month now. I had previously worked with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Prior to that, I worked last session in this building for Secretary Brown, and then two sessions ago I was an intern for Senator Bates. Honored to be appointed by the governor to the Respiratory Therapist Board. I'm appointed as a public member. I'm an asthma sufferer myself, so I have a vested interest in the efficient and effective operation of the industry, and I look forward to the opportunity to serve the state.
Any questions? Thank you very much for coming here today, and thank you for being willing to serve. Okay, I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Tanya Rain to the State Board of Licensed Social Workers.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Tanya Rain. I'm a Lake Oswego resident, and I am a student, a master's in management of aging services through Southern Oregon University. I spent the last 10 years working to move up the corporate ladder to find out that I would prefer to be more giving to my community. And therefore, I went back to school, and I've started doing a lot of volunteer work. I volunteer for Habitat for Humanity, the Volunteers of America, American Heart Association, and the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office. When I saw that I could become a public member of the Board of Licensed Social Workers, I found that this would be a great way to really get involved with the community and serve the state of Oregon. And I believe the most important function that this board does is as consumer protection, because there, most of us end up being in front of a social worker at some point, and being able to trust their guidance is very important. And that's why I would like to serve on this board.
Any questions for Ms. Rain? Seeing none, thank you very much for coming today. We'll take action on your appointment a little bit later.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to start the difficult task here. Close the public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointments of Mike Holland and Gary Weeks to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
I'm just getting Gary on.
Make it harder by breaking the microphone. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Mike.
Hold on Holland. Just a second. We'll see if we're going to do the phone one first, okay. And then we'll come back. So.
Great.
Oh, boy, this is bad. Mr. Weeks?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Would you just take about a minute or so to explain your interest in this appointment and your background?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I mean, first, I apologize for not being there on purpose, and I appreciate very much your willingness to consider this through a telephone call. I guess, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my interest is because of what has basically been a 45-year association with this commission. In 1965, I received a state scholarship from what was then called the State Scholarship Commission. I graduated from Brooklyn Harbor High School. 9 years later, I was appointed as the director of the grant program for that agency, ran the student grant program, and became ultimately deputy director of the department. Held that job for 10 years. So, one of my actually very first state agency jobs was with the State Scholarship Commission, and I left there to go to work for your legislative fiscal office. So, the opportunity after being a grantee and a member of the staff there, the opportunity to come back as a commissioner and to work in a field that I believe is vitally important is a great opportunity, and I appreciate very much the governor giving me the chance to do this. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to go through my resume of all the work that I've done subsequent to that. I've had the opportunity to work, I believe, with every member of this Senate Confirmation Committee, and I look forward to renewing those relationships in this new opportunity. So happy to answer any questions. That's a brief summary, Mr. Chairman, okay. I know.
Well, we all know your background pretty well. Any questions for Mr. Weeks? Well, Mr. Weeks, I don't see any questions. We will take action on your appointment a little bit later. If you're ever sent back here to testify before the legislature as a member of the commission, I'm sure you'll be very experienced.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. I appreciate it, and members of the committee as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Holland.
Yes. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Mike Holland. I live at 1123 29th Avenue Southwest in Albany, Oregon. I have spent roughly 40 years working in higher education, mostly in the state of Oregon, at various sectors, community colleges, independent universities, in the state. I have had a deep interest throughout my career in student access and student success, and so I was excited and pleased when the governor asked if I would serve on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and that's why I'm here today, and I hope to be able to continue to serve.
Any questions for Mr. Holland? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to serve, and we'll take action on your appointment just a little bit later.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on appointments of Robin Collin and Judge Mark Webb to the Sustainability Board. Judge Webb? Judge Webb, can you hear me?
I hear him.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you would just address us for about a minute and a half, tell us your interest in serving on the Sustainability Board and a little bit about your background, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Okay, thanks. So my interest is this, largely. I am the Grant County judge. Grant County, in terms of integrating or facilitating or sustaining the environment, the community, and the economy, that's front and center for my community and the constituents that I represent. So that's a primary interest, is to be a part of that at the state level. In addition, I think I'm pretty well suited for it, not just because of being an elected official with these responsibilities. I spent a number of years contracting in natural resource areas, and also have a pretty strong academic background, and I think that's suitable here because I think an important part of this board will be, or will involve, communicating with different stakeholders and the like, move some of these issues forward. So that's largely my background and my interest.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Webb? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to appear here by telephone, and we'll take action on your appointment in a few minutes, actually.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Ms. Collin.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robin Morris Collin. I'm a professor of law at Willamette University College of Law, 245 Winter Street Southeast, here in Salem, 97301. As a citizen of Oregon, I care deeply about the sustainability of its communities and its economy. I would like to serve my state in an area that I know well. I've established a national and an international reputation as a scholar and an activist in the field of sustainability. Most recently, my co-author and I have published the Encyclopedia of Sustainability, a three-volume book that's the first comprehensive reference work on sustainability to be published to date. It has earned positive reviews both from Oregon reviewers and from the Library Journal. I've also just published in a collection of essays about duties to the planet. The other essayists in this collection include the Dalai Lama, E.O. Wilson, Barack Obama, John Paul II, the Ecumenical Patriarch, Bartholomew I, Ursula Le Guin, and a few other luminaries. Finally, I'm the first law professor in the United States to teach a course on sustainability in a U.S. law school. I look forward to the opportunity to serve my state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be honored to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Collin? Seeing none, thank you very much for being so patient and waiting here today. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointments of Shirley Blanchard and Kathleen Sundell to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Ms. Blanchard.
Hi, Ms. Blanchard. Can you hear me? Ms. Blanchard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Ms. Blanchard, if you could just address the committee for a minute or two, tell us a little bit about your background and your interest in serving, and we'll see if there are any questions.
Thank you very much. And members of the committee, I am Shirley Blanchard. I live at 1939 Dry Creek Road in Eagle Point, Oregon. I am a teacher of 35 years, and I'm also nationally certified. I teach first grade during the day, and I teach for Concordia University at Medford campus night classes. I'm interested in being on the committee, one, because of my experience of 35 years, and two, because I have an ability to look at both sides of options and before forming an opinion. And it's one of my strengths, and it has proven to be a real asset in committee work, as I believe it will be on TSPC. And I think my wide range of experiences in K-12 and higher ed provide me with the knowledge to add input and to help make decisions in all three main areas of TSPC's authority. So if you have any questions for me, I would be happy to answer them.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Blanchard? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to be interviewed today by phone. We'll take action on your appointment in just a few minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Sundell?
Good afternoon, Senator DeDevil and the committee members. My name is Kathleen Sundell, and I live at 5970 Poppy Hill Street, Southeast Salem, Oregon. I'm currently a half-time teacher of resource room at Leslie Middle School, and I'm half-time release vice president of Salem-Keizer Education Association. I've also been in education for 35 years, and I've had experience in resource rooms, self-contained classrooms, and general education classrooms. I've worked with individuals in the classroom through inclusion, at home through homebound instruction. I've had experience with learning disabilities, mental disabilities, emotional disabilities, autistic spectrum, and other health-impaired students. I have completed staff meetings, individual educational plans, transition plans, and testing. I'm currently a member and the chair of the WOU Consortium. And the reason I want to serve as a TSPC commissioner is that I've always looked for a way to give back to my profession. I feel this is a way to serve through TSPC. My experience has been honed organizational skills as well as my adaptability, communication skills, collegiality, and collaboration. And I feel I'd be an excellent addition to TSPC. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Sundell? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness
thank
to serve
you.
And to give back to your profession also. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointments of Jenny Greenleaf, Mi Sun Kwan, and Erica Nabel to the Commission on Women. Please start in whatever order you choose.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Mi Sun Kwan. For the record, my American name is Claire Pierce, and my permanent address is 2140 Southwest 79th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97225. Currently, I am finishing my last year in political science at the University Honors College at Portland State University. And I also staff a U.S. representative and employed by the U.S. government and work with congressional services in Portland. I'm also the coordinator for alumni outreach for the Center for Women Politics and Policy, which houses New Leadership Oregon, educating and inspiring women leaders for the next generation. I am also the co-chair for the Asian Pacific American Voter Education Project, which is a partnership with the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs, the Oregon Asian Pacific American Bar Association, and APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. I believe the Commission occupies a unique role as a conduit by which women's needs can be voiced to their state government and disseminated to the public. In my mind, woman, the definition, encompasses a variety of boundaries: ethnic, racial, religious, sexual orientation, and geographic and age demographics as well. Policy affects women of all ages and backgrounds and communities. I hope to draw on my experiences with youth and mentoring young women and working with communities of color to serve and advocate women for women of all ages and disparate backgrounds. Thank you for your time today, and I'm honored to answer any questions.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erica Namioka-Niebel. I live at 4803 Southwest 1st Avenue, Apartment B, Portland, Oregon, 97239. Actually, I live in Senator Burdick's district. I am currently acquiring my degree at Portland State University for my bachelor's of political science and women's studies. I volunteered at various organizations and also for those who wanted to get elected. So I'm not a native Oregonian, although I've lived here for the last 17 years. Actually, I was born in Japan. I don't have too many clear memories from when I was younger, but I do have one that's very distinct, and that's every day my mother took me to work, with her to work, and although I did not understand at that time the strength and courage it took my mother to step outside the expectations of what it meant to be a woman, especially what it meant to be a woman in Japan, let me tell you, she definitely took care of business. I think women have an unmeasurable amount of knowledge and talent to offer, and I want the chance to be on the Oregon Commission for Women because I want the chance to help the women in our state to gain more equality, whether that's at the workplace or at school or at home or in politics and in leadership in general, which I'm most focused on, especially youth leadership, because I've graduated from New Leadership Oregon, which is a program that teaches college-aged women in Oregon leadership skills. So I believe that this commission will allow me to take the first step into doing that, to helping or representing the women that came before me and also helping the women, the countless number of women that will come after me. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Greenleaf. I live at 1604 Northeast 55th Avenue in the beautiful Rose City neighborhood of Portland, Oregon. I own a small technology consulting business along with my husband. I'm honored to be appointed to the Oregon Commission for Women. The status of women is a long-standing interest of mine, and I look forward to working with the other commissioners if appointed. As a member of the technology industry, I'm particularly interested in encouraging women to pursue careers in science and engineering. I'm also very interested in working to end domestic violence and ensuring that women who have limited economic opportunities have the ability to support themselves and their children. I have skills in the areas of communications, networking, and technology that I'd like to offer the commission, and I have several years of board experience in nonprofits, professional organizations, and political organizations. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for any of the three? Well, thank you very much for your willingness to serve, and we will take action on your appointments just a little bit later. That, just to explain, that action will be to recommend or not recommend to the full Senate, who will actually make the decision on confirmation. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, and I will open a public hearing on the appointment of Joni Cook to the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board.
Ms. Cook, are you on the telephone?
Yes, I am.
And Ms. Cook, would you please let the committee know, the Rules Committee know, why it is that you wish to be appointed to the Appraiser and Certification and Licensure Board?
I want to serve on the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board so I can be involved in the decision-making of issues that affect the appraisal industry, and also to protect the general public's interest in this time of mortgage crisis.
Thank you very much. Does the committee have any questions for this appointee, for Ms. Cook?
I'm the committee.
Yes, you
no
are.
No questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cook, for appearing today by telephone.
Okay, thank you very much.
Close the public hearing.
I'm just getting Mr. Wink on the phone.
So. Okay. Let us open a public hearing on Mr. Wink, who is appointed to the Building Code Structure Board. And we'll do that by telephone. Mr. Wink, can you hear us?
Mr. Wink?
Yes.
Mr. Wink, you're appearing telephonically before the Rules Committee, and we would like to hear from you about your interest in serving on the Building Code Structures Board.
Yes. Is it Chair Devlin?
Chair Devlin has stepped away. This is Vice Chair Ferrioli.
Hi, thank you. Yes, thank you for the opportunity today and for your understanding that I'm not able to be there in person today. I'm in West Virginia on a kind of work assignment with a comparable agency in the West Virginia, in the state of West Virginia. I'm an attorney with the Disability Rights Oregon office. I've worked there since about 1989, and I think I passed the Oregon Bar in 2000, and I'm serving on the State Rehabilitation Council, which has a designee on the Oregon, it's a big spot on the Oregon Disability Commission, and having a bit of experience with architectural access barriers under the ADA and the state law, when this opportunity came along to be on the Building Code Structure Board, I said that's that is something I'm very interested in and love to do, love to have the opportunity to do, and just ask you all for support in doing that. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Wenk. I see no questions from the committee, so we really appreciate your willingness to testify from your remote location and enjoy your conference. Thank you. Go ahead and close the public hearing on Mr. Wenk. We will go to Mr. Cooper, who is an appointee to the State Board of Denture Technology. Open the public hearing on Mr. Cooper's appointment. John Cooper, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Mr. Cooper, you're appearing telephonically before the Rules Committee, who's going to take action on your nomination to the State Board of Denture Technology. We'd like to hear a little about your interest in serving.
Okay, are you ready for me?
Yes, sir, when you are.
Okay, so I guess I'm addressing Chair Ferrioli.
Actually, you're addressing Vice Chair Ferrioli and Chair Devlin, and we have a quorum of the committee.
Okay, well, Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, my name is John Cooper. I live at 9425 Dillinger Lane here in Klamath Falls. My business here in Klamath Falls is called Western Denture Center. The reason I'm interested in this appointment is I'm one of a few number of denturists who I hold an associate degree in denture technology. As a person who has practiced this profession for around 30 years, I'm considered a master denturist. I've been encouraged by my peers to apply for this position. So I was licensed in 89. I've been involved in denturism since its beginning, back in, you know, between 76 and 79 when we were getting things legalized. Been involved in all changes since then. And I feel like I bring a perspective of both past and present to take the, you know, profession into the future. And that is why I applied for this position.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Cooper's just answered two of the burning questions that I had relative to this committee, and that is the proper pronunciation of denturism and denturist. I learned something today, so I appreciate his testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Cooper or statements? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Cooper. We will take action on your appointment in just a few moments.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of David Fior to the Oregon Educators Benefits Board. Mr. Fiore?
Fiore.
Fiore.
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Fiore, would you state your name for record and just address the committee for 1 or 2 minutes about your background and why you wish to serve?
Okay, thank you. Is this Chair Devlin?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is David J. Fiore. I live at 611 Northwest 3rd in Pendleton, Oregon. 97801. I've been there about 6 years. I guess my primary reason for applying for the position is that we need rural representation on the OEBB board as well as both of the boards of the state of Oregon. I think after my 6 years out here, I have a pretty unique perspective on the problems I've been collecting, but a few complaints, and also am very proud of the quick resolutions that OEBB has provided, so we're happy in that respect. We have some unique problems out here with pharmacy doctors and multi-state providers. A lot of our folks go out of state for their health care, so I think that's my primary reason. I've been a lifelong student of insurance, if you could tell by my application and my resume, and particularly health care. I think we need to better educate my members and the OEBB subscribers to be better consumers of healthcare. And I noticed that that's one of the goals of the OEBB, so I'm really excited about that. Fourth, I guess I would say that as costs escalate, it's squeezing the entire state budget. I don't need to tell you that, especially education and the money the state is able to send to our district. So my goal, I guess, would be to serve OEBB and serve my members out here and throughout the state to find some system-wide improvements in the healthcare that OEBB provides and not just shift the costs down the way and save money in that respect, but to change the overall system. So my background was safe. I've been with OEA. You've got a resume in front of you. I have to apologize. The same day I was asked to complete this application, I didn't read. I'm a UNICEF consultant, not a UNICEF consultant, and I'm sorry for that.
Well, thank you for that clarification, Mr. Fiore. This is Vice Chair Ferrioli. Does the committee have any questions? Seeing and hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Fiore, for your testimony.
You bet. I appreciate your time as well.
Close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on Andreas Papachristopoulos, who is being appointed to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots.
Very well pronounced, Mr. Vice Chair.
Not a problem.
I've been practicing it.
Can you hear us, Mr. Papachristopoulos?
I can hear you.
Yes, this is Vice Chair Ferrioli sitting in momentarily for Chairman of the Rules Committee, Senator Devlin. And the members here would like to hear a little about your interest in serving on the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. Can you help with that?
Sure. I have been in the shipping business for 35 years. And I feel that I can make a positive contribution to the Board of Maritime Pilots. I have seen a lot of changes in the viability of the Columbia River as a port, and I hope that my experience can be constructive to the Board of Maritime Pilots. And this is why I volunteer to serve.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the applicant? Well, thank you, Mr. Papachristopoulos. Your testimony is appreciated, and we will be taking action on your appointment later today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Close the public hearing.
Okay, wait.
Nicole.
We'll close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointments of Nicole Burnham and Harry Krulowich to the Nursing Home Administrators Board. Nicole, or Ms. Burnham?
Yes, hello.
This is Senator Devlin, and I'm here actually with the full Senate Rules Committee. If you could just state your name for the record and address the committee for 1 or 2 minutes, tell us a little bit about your background and why you wish to serve.
Sure, absolutely. My name is Nicole Evans-Burnham, and I am a licensed nursing home administrator and have been since 1999. I currently work for Marquee Companies, and I actually started with them in 1996, working in the nursing home industry. And I would like to be a part of the licensing committee for the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. I'd like to assure that excellent candidates come into our field, which can be a very challenging field at times, and I'd like to make sure that I'm part of that process to bring excellent people to work in nursing homes.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Burnham? Seeing none, thank you very much for being willing to call in, and we will take action on your appointment in a few minutes.
Okay, thank you so much.
Two left.
Oh, it's Jackson. Okay. Let me go ahead and close that this public hearing. Open Jackson's public hearing.
I have closed that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Jacqueline Balzar to the Oregon Voluntary Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. Ms. Balzar?
Correct.
Hi, this is Senator Devlin, You're here. I have a full complement for the Senate Rules Committee. If you could state your name for the record and just give us 1 or 2 minutes on your background and why you wish to serve.
Sure. My name is Jacqueline Leah Balzer. I'm an employee. I'm the Vice Provost for Student Affairs here at Portland State University, and I'm thrilled and honored to be considered for this appointment. I've been in higher education for just over 23 years now. As you can imagine, working in student affairs, that means working for many years with student activists, student leaders, student learners, as they construct their college years in a way that we hope they come out with a commitment to service, service learning, and making their community a better place to live. So, you know, I think it's very important someone from Portland State University or at least a high-level educator is a member of these type of commissions. And when it was suggested that I look into this and submit my materials, again, I was very honored.
Okay. Any questions?
No. I luckily was able to meet with Joy from the commission, and she briefed me on the expectations, the ambitious schedule, how I might be able to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Balzar. We will take action on your appointment in a few moments.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing. Do we have the final party?
We do.
Okay. I'm reopening a public hearing on the appointment of Harry Krulowicz to the Nursing Home Administrators Board.
Okay, we just lost him. He's on rounds, so we're trying to get him.
Krulowicz. It's a tough one. I had my jaw rebuilt by Dr. Schlatter.
All right.
Hi, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. Is this Harry Krulowicz?
Krulowicz.
Ms. Krulowicz, if you would please address the Senate Rules Committee, state your name, and just address us for 1 to 2 minutes on why you wish to serve and a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thank you very much, Senator Devlin. Thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Harry Krulowicz. I've lived in Portland since 1993 when I came back from the Midwest to work with the Sisters of Providence for Elder Place, which is a program where I work for 8 years making house calls for low-income elderly in the East Portland area. Since then, I've gone on to become president of the Oregon Geriatric Society, and 3 years ago, actually 8 years ago, I left Providence and started a private practice as a physician, and I'm doing geriatric work throughout the Portland area. I was president of the Oregon Geriatric Society 2 years ago, and I'm an active member of the Oregon Academy of Family Practice. I'm 60 this year. I've been pulling back to start my practice. I really feel like Oregon has been a wonderful opportunity for my family to grow up and raise my children, and need to have a practice for older people, which I personally enjoy. I helped raise my grandparents and took care of them until they died, and have a great fondness for working with older people, obviously. And wanted to give back to the state. I called the Oregon Academy of Family Practice and the Oregon Medical Association and asked if there was any way I could volunteer for any committees that would serve the geriatric community. And a few months later was told that there might be an opening for the State Board of Nursing Home Directors, and that they would like a physician with experience working in nursing homes who's familiar with the legal as well as personal issues and clinical issues to represent the physician community and to contribute. And I thought that would be a great place for me to do something of service for the state that's been so good to my family and myself. And I think that's all that's what I'd like to be able to do, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. So,
and then subject to if any member wants to split, I'll split it. I'd love to be in there.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes. Okay, any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to serve. We will take action on your appointments a little bit later in this meeting.
That's fine. I'll certainly clear my line in case some phone calls should come up. And again, I'm very grateful for the chance to participate and for citizens and to help our patients that are in nursing homes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I perceive that you're going to make an unblock motion for confirmation.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I do not object to that. I have not had a chance to talk to any of the members who may wish to have a nomination separated. I will forego my usual no vote on all the teacher standards and practices commission appointees in the interest of moving the agenda forward. And I make that no vote because the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, which has the responsibility of certifying teachers, does nothing to measure their competency in the subject areas for which they are hired to teach. So I think it is an organization that does the background examinations and determines the educational attainment, all functions that could easily happen in the under the purview of building administrators or school board executive directors, and as long as TSPC isn't going to do anything about the competency of teachers, I see no reason for the organization to exist. So, but I will not stand against your motion en bloc. I also have real heartburn with the Sustainability Commission, Mr. Chairman, watching natural resource industries decimated in the name of environmentalism and hearing it called sustainability over all these years. But, Mr. Chairman, please proceed with your motion, if you wish.
And Senator Farioli, I'd be glad to split any of those apart now, but you also know that I would be very glad to split any of those appointments apart on the floor so that people can vote their individual, make their individual decision on the appointments.
Mr. Chairman, I think that all of our members on both sides of the aisle appreciate that courtesy very much.
Okay. Now.
Can we open work session?
Okay. I'm opening a work session moving the following appointments and reappointments to the following boards and commissions to the Senate floor with the recommendation that they be confirmed en bloc. Christopher Brown as Superintendent of State Police. Joni Cook as the Appraiser and Licensor Certification Board. Cliff Walker and Willie Wolfuck to the Commission on Black Affairs. Blake Alexander, Tony Barsotti, Kenneth Hill, and Greg Moyer to the Board of Boiler Rules. Theodore Wenk to the Building Code Structures Board. Bridget Burns to the State Commission on Children and Families. Anton Minthorne to the Columbia River Gorge Commission. Roger Nyquist to the Construction Contractors Board. John Cooper to the State Board of Denture Technology. Samuel Henry to the State Board of Education. David Fiore and Steve McNanny to the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, Melanie Adams and Bruce Freeman to the Electrical and Elevator Board, Mary McKay and Dennis Ross to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, Lisa Dotson to the Oregon Health Services Commission, Katie Durant to the Oregon Investment Council, Michael Holston and Melissa Ryan to the Land Use Board of Appeals, Michael Dubik and Gregory Evans to the Lane Transit District, Mary Beth Pearl-Gent to the Trustees of the State Library, Tanya Ryan to the State Board of Licensed Social Workers, Daniel Dunham to the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee, Amy Lowry to the Oregon State Lottery Commission, Andres Papakristopoulos, oh my goodness, I'm not going to do this one on the floor. To the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, Karen Thompson and Jay Winchester to the Mechanical Board, William Purnell to the Board of Medical Imaging, Linda Glenn to the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, Lynn Stranger to the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, Nicole Burnham to the and Harry Krulwich to the Nursing Home Administrators Board, Jessica Lynch to the Oregon Board of Optometry, Michael Adelman, Shannon Pullen, and Frank Warner to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, Jill Rissy and James Wotham to the Board of Directors of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, Christine Shute to the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy, Jennifer Wood to the Physical Therapy Licensure Board, Sky Dancy to the State Plumbing Board, Paul McKenna to the Public Employees Benefit Board, Pat West to the Public Employees Retirement System, David Batista and Sarah Boley to the Quality Education Commission, Kevin Parks to the Respiratory Therapist Licensing Board, Mike Holland and Gary Weeks to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Robin Collin, Trey Sen, Sarah Vickerman, and Judge Mark Webb to the Sustainability Board, Bill Beck, Shirley Blanchard, Milton Dennison, Shirley Modatil, Jeffrey Matsumoto, and Kathleen Sundell to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Jacqueline Balzar to the Oregon Voluntary Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, Jenna Greenleaf and Megan Harris Chiquote, Mi Si Kwan, and Erica Nabel to the Commission for Women. Any additional discussion? Yes, Senator Fairness.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in interest of full disclosure, Mr. Webb, who's the judge of the Grant County Court in Grant County, Oregon, is the chief executive of Grant County, and my wife works for Grant County. Oh. So I just disclose there's, you know, the professional relationship there.
And that's noted for the record.
Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Senator Metzger, will you carry the motion? Should this need to be split, and I will let it decide it between the two of you, depending upon what is split apart. If you're needed, Senator Burdick or Senator Atkinson, will you carry whatever is split apart?
Happy to serve.
Happy to serve, and I will carry Mr. Papakristopoulos, since I can pronounce his name.
Okay. Well, that will be in Senator Metzger's actual motion, unless he chooses, and I think actually Senator Metzger can pronounce it correctly. So with that, I think our work for today is completed, and we will be back in this committee in December.
All right.